Pale blue triangles swing across the screen, resolving themselves into the letters UA. White letters under them read United Artists. Daytime. Under light cloud, a convoy of dark blue lorries, motorcycles and cars rolls along a pale strip of road between green fields. A small village lies ahead of them. The Mirisch Company presents Steve McQueen, James Garner, Richard Attenborough in The Great Escape. The long line of lorries crests a slight hill with dark green pine trees to one side and meadows on the other. Co-starring James Donald, Charles Bronson, Donald Pleasance, James Coburn, Hannes Messimer, David McCallum, Gordon Jackson, John Layton, Angus Lenny. From close to, the order of convoy can be seen. Two soldiers on motorcycles wearing the dark blue uniforms of the German Luftwaffe are followed by two motorcycle combinations, the men in the sidecars with rifles slung across their backs. Behind them come two high, square, dark blue cars with canvas hoods. An open truck with four armed soldiers in the rear leads the first of the big lorries. Behind the cabs, the backs of the lorries are covered with tarpaulins, also dark blue and tightly tied down. More motorbikes and the occasional armoured car punctuate the long line of lorries. The convoy winds out of a village of neat white houses with red tiled roofs, climbing a road bordered with poplars. Music by Elmer Bernstein, based on the book by Paul Brickhill. Screenplay by James Clavell and W.R. Burnett. Produced and directed by John Sturgis. On the screen, more words appear. This is a true story. Although the characters are composites of real men, and time and place have been compressed, every detail of the escape is the way it really happened. The convoy reaches a group of huts built of new white pine. They stand on sandy ground in front of a high fence which encloses a compound. At the corner of the fence, two watchtowers loom ominously. One of the cars stops by the huts. The passing lorries throw up clouds of yellow dust. A German in the uniform of the Luftwaffe gets out of the car and helps out two British officers, one in a fleece-lined flying jacket, the other in khaki battle dress. They look around expressionlessly, watched by two immaculately uniformed Luftwaffe officers who are standing on the veranda of a hut. The motorcycles stop next to the officer's car and the riders dismount. Luftwaffe men armed with submachine guns run from the troop carriers into a long line facing the backs of the lorries, which are now standing in a row. At the back of each lorry, two more Luftwaffe men undo the ropes holding down the canvas covers and drop the tailgates. They spring up onto the lorries, throw back the tarpaulins, and from inside, men in a shabby mixture of uniforms, a few in civilian clothes, hop down and gaze at the fenced compound. Most are carrying bedrolls or small bundles of possessions, one a guitar. A slightly older German officer joins the two on the veranda, hands clasped behind his back, watching the prisoners ambling past the guards towards the compound. Two high gates swing open. The fence is actually two fences, with a gap of a metre and a half between them and a gate in each. The prisoners stroll into the compound. On the veranda, the older officer takes a brown document case from one of the others and goes back inside. In the compound, a short, stocky prisoner in a red jumper with a kit bag over his shoulder walks to the fence as if assessing it. Another, a slim man with cropped fair hair, wanders up to one of a series of short posts stuck in the ground and kicks it gently. Glancing up, he sees a guard gazing down from a watchtower, slowly patting the heavy machine gun at his side. The slim man bends, picks up a handful of loose earth, and wanders away, tossing it in his hand. A tall, dark RAF officer notices the wire strung between the short posts running inside the perimeter fence. The officer looks up and catches the eye of guards in two watchtowers. He wanders off. three prisoners, the first with a thick blonde moustache, stride through a hut and into a dormitory.
Yeah, this'll do. Now, which one are you going to have?
Oh, I'll have that.
Nope, that's mine. Hey!
The chap with the moustache slings his kit bag onto the top bunk and follows it up. He lies back contentedly. Outside, a slim man in the dark blue uniform of the Royal Navy walks alongside a hut. He stops, takes a swift look around, drops to one knee and inspects the open area beneath the hut. He stands and moves away. A lanky man wearing a forage cap walks down the steps from another hut and takes a sip from a water standpipe. He spits it out and mooches off, followed by two others. Two more men, one fair, one dark, stroll around the perimeter. The fair man looks beyond the fence.
How far are the trees, Danny?
Over 200 feet.
Yeah, I'd say 300.
Long ways to dig.
We'll get Cavendish to make a survey. I wish Big X were here.
Billy, you think X got away?
I'd have sent his word somehow if he had.
Gestapo, you think?
Either that or he's dead.
They move off. The guards swing both sets of big gates shut. Outside, the officer who arrived by car is helped out of his coat by his companion in khaki battle dress. A German officer approaches them.
Group Captain Ramsey?
Yes?
I am Hauptfeldwebel Strachwitz. Will you accompany me, please?
I'll look after your gear, sir.
Right.
Group Captain Ramsey, limping and using a stick, follows Strachwitz into a wooden hut. Inside, a clerk is typing. The officer who took the document case is standing at attention behind a desk.
Gruppenkommandeur Ramsey.
Morning, Group Captain. I'm Captain Posen, von Luger's adjutant. Since a senior British officer, you are to be liaison between the prisoners and the colonel. I wish to make clear to you certain matters of the Boris policy.
Yes?
Thank you.
Posen turns to a door behind him. The colonel is leaning back against his desk. He takes his hands from his pockets as Posen holds the door open for Ramsey.
Gruppenkommandeur Ramsey.
I'm Colonel von Luger. Please sit down.
While Ramsey sits, von Luger strolls behind his desk, where he remains standing. The Iron Cross is hanging on his breast pocket.
Group Captain Ramsey, in the past 4 years, the Reich has been forced to spend an enormous amount of time, energy, manpower and equipment, hunting down escaping prisoner of war officers.
Well, at least it's rather nice to know you're wanted, isn't it?
For us, it's not a matter for levity. There will be no escapes from this camp.
Colonel von Luger, it is the sworn duty of all officers to try to escape. If they can't, it is their sworn duty to cause the enemy to use an inordinate number of troops to guard them, and their sworn duty to harass the enemy to the best of their ability.
Yes, I know. The men under your authority have been most successful. This man, Ashley Pitt, for example. Caught in the North Sea, escaped, recaptured. Archibald Archie Ives. 11 escape attempts. He even tried to jump out of the truck coming here. Dix, William. Known to have participated in digging of 11 escape tunnels. Flight Lieutenant Wilinski, 4 escapes. MacDonald, 9. Handlers, American, 5. Haynes, 4. Sedgwick, 7. The list is almost endless. One man here has made 17 attempted escapes. Group captain, this is close to insanity.
Quite.
And it must stop.
Colonel, do you expect officers to forget their duty?
No. It is because we expect the opposite that we have brought you here. This is a new camp. It has been built to hold you and your men. It is organized to incorporate all we have learned of security measures. And in me, you will not be dealing with a common jailer, but with a staff officer personally selected for the task by the Luftwaffe High Command. We have in effect put all our rotten eggs in one basket, and we intend to watch this basket carefully.
Very wise.
You will not be denied the usual facilities. Sports, a library, a recreation hall, and for gardening we will give you tools. We trust you to use some for gardening, devote your energies to see things. Give up your hopeless attempts to escape. And as an intelligent corporation, we may all sit out the war as comfortably as possible.
After a moment's hesitation, Ramsay accepts a cigarette from von Luger. The tall, dark officer who was examining the alarm wires around the perimeter stops by a blue pickup truck. He glances round, looks into the cab, and tries the door handle. A guard hurries up to him.
What do you do here by the truck?
I'm stealing tools.
For stealing tools? Cooler!
No, I was only kidding. I wasn't stealing tools.
Oh, you're American.
Yes, and you're a German.
Of course. Why do you come to Germany? Why fight for England, your enemy?
Enemy? What are you talking about?
In 1812, they burned your capital.
That's propaganda.
It's in the history
books. Pure propaganda.
I read it. And now go away from here. If you steal tools, cooler.
Yeah, no tools.
The guard looks into the cab as the American walks away. The man who first spotted the posts is joined by another.
Hey, Virgil. Hey. Did you see the cooler? Boy, is it ever a big one.
I think they expect a lot of business.
Yeah. Hey, those two guys were with us in the old camp in Hut 14. I can't find them. You think the goons left them behind or something?
I guess.
Yeah. Hey, what were their names? It was Jackson and...
And Dexter.
Dexter, that's right. Hey, I'm gonna see who else I can find. I'll see you later.
Virgil looks around and up. In a watchtower, a guard glances back. 20 yards away, another one is watching. Virgil looks again at the fence, barbed wire running vertically and horizontally, making squares barely a foot wide. Behind that, another identical fence. Virgil strides to a hut, drops his bag, leans against the wall and watches. The fair man and his dark companion continue their inspection.
Hey, Danny, who are they?
Russian prisoners. They cut down trees.
Well, they keep them here?
Nah, they take them out.
The dark man, Danny, looks again at the shabby workers.
Willie, cigarettes.
He takes Willie's kit bag, drops it, and takes off his jacket. Willie gives him 2 cigarettes. Danny whispers in Willie's ear. Willie takes the uniform jacket and looks slowly around the compound. Leaving Danny leaning against the side of a hut, Willie walks quickly to a group of men, including the lanky water taster.
Danny and I have a blitz in mind. Could you put on some sort of brief show for the goons?
Sure, mate. What'll it be? An all-out gown?
Mad prisoner?
Choir practice.
Oh, Knuckles, eh?
Yeah, Knuckles will be fine.
Give him the coat.
Willie gives the coat to one man, and the lanky man grabs it off him.
What are you doing with my coat, mate?
What are you talking about? It's mine.
Are you pushing me, you cowing Canadian?
It's mine, you illiterate Aussie servant.
The lanky Aussie hits him, and a crowd gathers as they fall to the ground fighting. While the two men roll around, Danny shoves his way into the middle of the Russian workers. He tugs at one man's overcoat, offers one of his cigarettes in return, and hastily pulls on the coat. A man behind him offers him an axe in return for the other cigarette. Danny takes it, while Willie is diving under a pile of pine branches on the back of a pickup truck.
Stop it! Stop this nonsense!
It's all right, mate. We're just having a friendly little argument.
And no more fighting. No more!
All right.
Get back in your huts.
Yes, sir.
You too! Get away! Get back in your huts!
The grey-haired Luftwaffe man dismisses the fighters.
Gone!
He angrily waves the crowd away and they shuffle off. Virgil, still by the corner of a hut, bends down and takes a white ball and a brown leather baseball catching mitt from his bag and wanders into the open, throwing himself catches. Other officers stroll by, taking no notice, and as Virgil chucks the ball from hand to mitt, he sneaks a look up at a guard in a watchtower. He looks over at a second tower as his American friend runs over to him from the huts.
Hey, help! Hey! Hey, it looks like there's only one other American in the whole camp, some guy named Henley in the RAF Eagle Squadron. Hey, you got something going already?
Shh. See the way the goons got those towers placed?
Yeah?
A blind spot right in the middle.
A blind spot?
See, I could stand at that wire and not be seen by that tower or that tower. The one on the end is too far. They'd never see me, especially at night.
You're crazy!
You think so? Well, let's find out. Right now.
He lobs the ball over the low wire, and it rolls on, stopping at the foot of the fence. Virgil looks around, eyes narrowed against the bright sun. A guard glances down and looks away. The guard in the neighboring tower does likewise. Virgil takes a deep breath.
Now, the next step's a little tricky.
You're not going out there.
Well, they'll look at him now.
The two men look up at the towers once more.
I think I'll take a little walk.
Up, Nilo! March!
Virgil's friend backs slowly away as guards wave forward the contingent of Russians who shamble towards the gates, heads bowed. The lanky Australian dashes along the side of a hut and waits anxiously behind a line of prisoners, watching the Russians file past. He's wearing a greatcoat and pulls on a big woolen hat before slipping in amongst the Russians just behind Danny. One of the pickups loaded with pine branches moves off too. Among the Russians, Danny runs his hand through his thick black hair. He grabs a fur hat from an old man and sticks it on. The Aussie moves alongside him.
Danny, you speak Russian?
A little, but only one sentence.
Well, let me have it, mate.
Я вас люблю.
Я вас
люблю.
Люблю. Я вас люблю. Я вас люблю. What's it mean?
I love you.
Love you? What bloody good is that?
I don't know. I wasn't going to use it myself.
As the pickup passes down a line of huts, two figures hurl themselves from one of the roofs onto the pine branches and swiftly burrow beneath them. The Russians, led by two guards, approach the gates, which swing open before them. The tall German officer Strachwitz watches them pass through.
Hans!
Strachwitz walks wearily to the waiting Russians and stands in front of the Aussie.
Out.
Out!
Нет, нет, товарищ.
Ah, your friend, yes?
Товарищ.
And who vouches for you, Lieutenant Wielinski? Get out, Sedwick.
As the Aussie leaves the column, Strachwitz takes Danny's axe, pulls off his hat, and stares. Danny takes off the coat and returns it to its Russian owner.
Спасибо.
Strachwitz steps aside.
Marsch!
The Russians move off again. Strachwitz reaches out and takes a hayfork from one of them. Colonel von Luger strides along the veranda of his hut, pulling on his gloves and smiling at Captain Posen. The pickup reaches the gates and stops. Strachwitz steps forward and thrusts the fork into the branches. He moves along, thrust it in again.
Hold it, hold it!
The short prisoner in the red jumper clambers out from under the branches, his boots tied round his neck.
Your name?
Ives.
Ives. Ives. Oh yes, Archibald Ives, Scott. The photograph doesn't do justice.
I'd like to see one of you under similar circumstances.
Ives jams his beret defiantly on his head and hops down from the truck. Strachwitz moves ominously towards the second truck. As he stabs the fork in, Ives puts two fingers to his lips. Willie crawls out from the branches, jumps down and leans glumly against the truck.
I will not take action against you now. This is the first day here and there has been much stupidity and carelessness. On both sides.
Back in the compound, Virgil casually walks up to the wire running between the short posts and steps over it. He walks to the first fence, spins round and stands with his back flat against the barbed wire looking up at the watchtowers. His friend watches him nervously, well away from the wire. In one of the towers, a guard takes aim.
Hey! Get out!
Virgil retreats, prisoners come running, and a guard rushes up to him.
You fool! To cross a wire is death!
What wire?
This wire! The only wire!
Oh.
It's absolutely forbidden to cross it, you know that!
Yeah, but my baseball rolled over there. How am I gonna get my baseball?
You first ask permission!
Oh, okay.
He heads back to the fence.
Get my baseball!
Stop this nonsense! Get over the wire! Immediately!
Okay.
You stay there! Out of the way.
Strachwitz shoves through the crowd of prisoners and strides over to Virgil.
What are you doing over here by the wire?
Well, like I told Max here, I was trying to get my gun.
Colonel von Luger marches forward grimly. Virgil waits, hands on hips.
What were you doing by the wire?
Well, like I told Max, I was trying to cut my way through your wire because I want to get out.
Durchsuchen Sie ihn.
Bitte.
Virgil pulls a metal implement from the waistband of his trousers and hands it to the colonel.
You speak German?
Jawohl, Herr Oberst.
Wire cutters?
Jawohl, Herr Oberst.
I have had the pleasure of knowing quite a number of British officers in this war, and I flatter myself that we understand one another.
Both Germans look round slowly. Flying Officer Ives grins inanely.
You are the first American officer I've met. Hills, isn't it?
Captain Hills, actually.
17 escape attempts.
18, sir.
Tunnel man, engineer.
Flyer.
I suppose what's called in the American Army a hotshot pilot. Uh-huh. Unfortunately, you were shot down anyway. So we are both grounded for the duration of the war.
Well, you speak for yourself, Colonel.
They gaze at each other.
You have other plans?
I haven't seen Berlin yet, from the ground or from the air, and I plan on doing both before the war is over.
Are all American officers so ill-mannered?
About 99%.
Then perhaps while you are with us, you will have a chance to learn some. 10 days isolation, Hiltz.
Captain Hiltz.
20 days.
Right.
Virgil turns away, then turns back.
You'll still be here when I get out.
Cooler.
Virgil smiles and saunters towards the cooler. Von Luger turns to face the crowd.
Name?
Ives. Flying officer, Ives.
Cooler, 20 days.
Ives doesn't move, and Strachwitz strides over to him.
Cooler, Ives.
Pleasure.
With a smile, Ives follows Virgil at a jaunty march. A fellow prisoner pats him on the back. The prisoners and Von Luger watch Strachwitz and two guards marching behind Ives and Virgil to a gate, which the officer unlocks. Ives and Virgil march into a small compound. A guard opens the door of a hut and they enter. The small windows inside are set into the concrete walls 2 feet above a man's head, the atmosphere cool and shadowy. Ives stops in front of a door and grins at the young guard, who unlocks it. Inside, he leans back against the door and his grin fades slightly as he hears the lock turn. Virgil waits at the next door, which another guard opens. Virgil steps inside. The guard reaches to lock up. The door opens again and Virgil hands him out his own key ring. The guard snatches it and locks him in. Inside his cell, Virgil gazes around. He tries the door, walks over to the window, jumps up to grasp the bars and pulls himself up. He peers outside for a few seconds, drops down, looks around the 10-foot square cell, turns by the door, slides to a sitting position, and picks up his ball and mitt. With an angry grimace, he throws the ball into the mitt viciously before chucking it against the wall and catching it. Next door, Ives leans against a wall.
Hiltz.
Yeah?
What did you do in the States? Play baseball.
I was in college. Say, Ives.
Hi.
How many escapes have you tried?
Four over, seven under.
Tunnel man, huh?
Sure, I'm that.
How tall are you, Ives?
5'4". Why?
Oh, just wondering.
What did you do in college? Study physical education.
Chemical engineering. Did a little bike riding, though.
Bicycles?
Motorcycles. You know, flat tracks, county fairs. Picked up a buck here and there. Helped pay my tuition.
Oh, I did a wee bit racing myself. In Scotland.
Bikes?
No, horse racing. Jockey.
Jockey. Jockey.
Ives walks over to the grating in the door.
Hiltz? Are you there, Hiltz?
Yeah, I'm here.
Don't you have them in the States, jockeys?
Sure.
Oh, they were the days. Some of these Saturday nights in towns like Musselburgh and Hamilton. You'd to fight off the birds. You know, birds. Girls, man, girls. Do you know of them in the States?
Virgil takes some small stones from his pocket.
Hilt! Are you there, Hilt? Ives.
Virgil goes to the grating in his own door. A group of prisoners gather outside a hut.
What do you think, Navy?
must say, it's an interesting first 20 minutes.
Well, I'd say we made fools of ourselves.
Sergeant out there says, this is only the first day.
They all stare beyond the fence, where two big open-topped cars drive up to the commandant's hut and stop. Guards, two German officers, two civilians, and a British officer in handcuffs get out. Captain Posen comes out and salutes them.
Eric, don't take too much notice. The goons may not know who he is. I'll pass the word.
I'll tell the old man.
The naval officer enters the prison hut.
That's right.
In his office, von Luger looks up coldly as a hat plops on his desk. A civilian comes to his side and puts down a thick file.
The prisoner Bartlett is discharged into your custody, Colonel von Luger.
Bartlett and an SS officer stand facing the colonel. The civilian drops keys on the desk. Another civilian, wearing a long leather coat, sits opposite von Luger.
I suggest this prisoner Bartlett to be kept under the strictest security confinement permanently.
Make a note. A Van Koon's suggestion.
We have reason to believe that this prisoner is the leader of numerous criminal escape attempts.
Squadron leader Bartlett has been 3 months in your care. And the Gestapo has only reason to believe...
If he once more falls into our hands, he will not be so lucky.
Air Force officer prisoners are the responsibility of the Luftwaffe. Not SS!
He looks at the two civilians.
Or the Gestapo.
At present, yes, Herr Oberst. That is why he's returned for the moment to your care.
Of course, if the Luftwaffe is not up to the task, the prisoner will find themselves totally in our charge. We regretfully are not so professionally understanding.
The Gestapo men start to leave.
Squadron leader Bartlett, if you escape again and be caught, you will be shot. Heil Hitler.
Heil Hitler.
Von Luger continues to write, then looks up. He blots the ink.
Heil Hitler.
The Gestapo men stare at him before turning away.
Herr Kuhn!
Von Luger holds up the paper. The first Gestapo man returns to the desk and takes it. He goes with a little toss of the head. Von Luger stares at Bartlett, who slowly releases his breath and relaxes.
Nehmen Sie den Mann diese Dinger ab.
Von Luger gives the keys to Posen, who unlocks Bartlett's wrists. Bartlett marches into the compound to be met by the naval officer.
Eric, hello, Roger. They dumped you in here, too.
Yes, what's this one like?
Well, it's new.
Yeah.
Let's find you a bed.
Thanks.
Eric takes Bartlett's kit bag and they cross the compound, watched by Posen and Strachwitz. Other prisoners stop and stare, too, as Eric and Bartlett enter Ramsey's hut.
Come in.
Hello, Roger.
Sir. I'll put your bag in your room.
Thanks, Harry. How are you?
They shake hands.
Well, it could be expected.
The fellows wanted to put up a welcome committee for you, but that's for later.
Yes, I saw William Valinsky with Mac.
Lot of old friends here.
How long have you been here, sir?
Arrived today. New camp, expert guards, the elite. You met the commandant?
Yes, I did.
What were the Gestapo and the SS doing with you?
Oh, they wanted to find out who'd helped me to the border. Who else is here? We got Cavendish.
Mm-hmm.
Nimmer and Sorin.
Griffiths. Haynes.
Blythe?
Yes.
Almost the whole ex-organization.
Almost. They cleaned out all the other camps and dumped us in this one. As von Luger put it, all the rotten eggs in one basket.
There's madness in their method. What about Tommy Bristol?
No, but there's an American, Hendley.
Is he a scrounger? Blackmailer?
McDonald says he's the best.
Good.
Last of the tea until the Red Cross gets through again. I scrounged this from Sedgwick.
Bartlett stares out of the window. Ramsey sits back in his chair.
Did the Gestapo give you a rough time?
Not nearly as rough as I now intend to give them.
Roger, personal revenge must be kept out of what we have to do here. Too many lives are at stake.
What my personal feelings are is of no importance. You appointed me Big X. And it's my duty to harass, confound, and confuse the enemy to the best of my ability.
That's true.
And that's what I intend to do. I'm going to cause such a terrible stink in this Third Reich of theirs that thousands of troops that could well be employed at the front will be tied up here looking after us.
How?
By putting more men out of this perfect camp of theirs than have ever escaped before. Oh, not blitzing out two or three or a dozen, but 200, 300. Scatter them all over Germany.
Do you think that's possible?
Well, the men are here to do it. The goons have put every escape artist in Germany in this camp. You say so yourself.
Have you thought of what it might cost?
I've thought of the humiliation if we just tamely submit. Knuckle under and crawl. Surely you don't advocate that, do you, sir?
I have to point out one thing to you, Roger. No matter how unsatisfactory this camp may be, the High Command have still left us in the hands of the Luftwaffe, not the Gestapo and the SS.
Look, sir, you talk about the High Command and the Luftwaffe, and then you talk about the SS and the Gestapo. To me, they're the same. We're fighting the bloody lot. There's only one way to put it, sir. They are the common enemies of everyone who believes in freedom. If the High Command didn't approve of Hitler, then why didn't they throw him out?
I have no argument with you, Roger. As senior officer, I'm merely pointing out a pertinent fact. When are you calling a meeting, X?
Bartlett, stocky and round-faced, is staring at the tabletop. He looks up at Ramsay and grins.
Tonight.
Night. Guards patrol, lit by the glow of lights on the huts and the watchtower searchlights. Bartlett stands behind a table, addressing a group of a dozen men.
Gentlemen, no doubt you've heard the immortal words of our new commandant. Devote your energies to things other than escape and sit out the war as comfortably as possible. Well, that's exactly what we're going to do. We're going to devote our energies to sports and gardening, all the cultural pursuits as far as they're concerned. In fact, we're going to put the goons to sleep. Meanwhile, we dig. Now, even a superficial look at the compound shows us that huts 104 and 5 are closest to the woods. The first tunnel goes out from 105, directly east under the Vorlager, the Cooler, and the Wire.
But that's over 300 feet, Roger.
Did you make a survey, Dennis?
Only a temporary one, sir. I make it just over 335 feet.
Let me know when you've got an exact one, Willie. This time we'll dig straight down 30 feet before we go horizontal. That'll rule out any question of sound detection or probing.
All right, Roger, but did you say the first tunnel?
I did. There'll be three. We'll call them Tom, Dick and Harry. Tom, as I said, goes out directly east from 104. Dick goes north from the kitchen. And Harry goes out parallel to Tom from 105. If the goons find one, we'll move into the other.
How many men do you plan to take out, Roger?
250. But there'll be no half measures this time, gentlemen. There'll be identification papers and documents for everyone. And Griff, we'll need outfits for the lot.
250?
Mostly civilian clothes.
Yes, but, okay, Roger.
Mac, maps. Blankets, rations, compasses for all the walkers, and timetables for every train.
Right, Roger.
The door is open for a man who salutes, then smiles shyly.
Sorry I'm late, Roger. All right, Colin, sit down. We're going to tunnel.
Colin takes off his cap. He's bald.
Splendid.
Willie, you and Danny will be tunnel kings. Danny, you'll be in charge of traps, and I'll work out the exact location with you tomorrow.
Good.
Sedgwick, manufacturer. Griff, as I said, tailor. Nimmon Haynes, diversions. Mac, of course, will take care of intelligence. Henley, we haven't met. Scrounger?
Right.
He and the tall, dark man shake hands.
Dennis, maps and surveys. Colin, you'll take your usual job. Eric, have you thought how you're going to get rid of this dirt?
Yes, I have. Usual places. Hadn't anticipated three tunnels, but we'll manage.
Roger, who's going to handle security for all this? You are. I want a system of stooges covering this compound from front to back, checking every goon in and out. I want a signal system so perfect that if ever a ferret gets within 50 feet of any of the huts in which we're working, we can shut down without a sign. Well,
I don't think there's much point in discussing any more now. I'll meet each of you in turn on the exercise circuit and we'll pound out the details. Nothing else, is there, Mac?
I shouldn't think so, Roger.
Mac smiles with grim confidence. Hendley enters his room and frowns. He examines the name stenciled on the brown suitcase lying on the lower bunk, then looks curiously at the group of shiny little tins standing on the table. He picks one up by its soldered-on handle and smiles as he sees the careful punctures in the base. Colin opens the door, carrying a saucepan.
Oh, hello. My name's Blythe.
Colin blinks several times.
Hendley.
Hendley looks at a pair of binoculars while Colin sits and pours water into a large tin.
The birds.
I used to do a little hunting myself.
Well, not hunting. Watching.
Oh, bird watcher?
Yes, that's right. Watching them and drawing them.
Hendley raises his eyebrows.
I suppose you have bird watchers in the States?
Yes, we have some.
Hendley opens the door of an empty locker.
Tea?
I only drank tea once in the hospital.
Where's your kit?
This is it. The rest was confiscated in the last shakedown. The goons didn't appreciate some of my more personal items.
He slips a multi-purpose tool from the collar of his flying jacket.
Such as?
He opens it.
You're the scrounger.
Yes, that's right.
I'll need a camera.
What kind?
A good one. A 35mm f2.8 with a focal plane shutter should do all right.
All right.
And film, of course.
Of course.
Oh, Hendley, I need a pick. Big, heavy one.
Only one?
Two would be better.
Hendley shuts the door behind Danny. Colin carefully pours water through a small tin.
Fred, this tea is pathetic. Must have used these wretched leaves about 20 times. It's not that I mind so much. Tea without milk is so uncivilized.
I got our wood.
Hendley goes into a bigger room where several men are lying on bunks or sitting at a table. He picks up small pieces of wood, stacking them on one arm.
Close up! Close up!
Two guards bolt the door from the outside and close the wooden shutters over the windows. Inside, someone closes a window.
Close up! Close up! Close up! Close up!
Nobody spreckens the English.
Close up!
Wearily, Hendley shuts another window, staring out as the shutters slam home, and turns grimly as more shutters are closed. He takes the wood and a small tin of condensed milk back to his room. Colin meets him at the door, takes the tin, and sits. Frowning, Hendley watches Colin painstakingly pouring milk into a tin mug, then tenderly pouring his tea.
Blythe, what are you doing here?
Oh, I'm in photographic aerial reconnaissance interpretation. Went for a joyride to see for myself. It's my own silly fault. The aircraft bought it. Got shot down. Terrifying.
No, I mean... What do you do here?
Here? Oh, I'm the forger.
He smiles shyly before sipping his tea. On a sunny day, a long column of men in pairs strolls around the compound perimeter. They wander past the long timber huts, some with smoke swirling up from the chimneys. One group comprises Griffith, the tailor, Sedgwick, the tall Aussie, and ahead of them, Bartlett and Mac.
The forgers are installing themselves in the recreation hut. Sedgwick?
I'm at 110.
Griffith?
Well, I'd like to work in 109, Roger.
109? Right. I'll work in 107. For now, Danny and Willie and their trap team will be in 104.
Mac, I want to take a chance on the tunnels and press ahead without any shoring up. But we will need timber, of course, both for the shafts and the entrance chambers.
Now, Henley figures there are 36 empty bunks. We can tear up 15 of them and move the men back and forth in the hut so that the goons won't miss them. The rest will come from the strips off the wall, as we've always done.
Is Henley taking care of this himself?
Not yet. He's working on some steel for a pick that Danny needs.
Bartlett smiles wryly. Ahead, men are loading rubbish bins onto trucks. Standing at a long trough for washing directly behind some guards is Virgil's American friend. Hendley, leaning casually against a wall, raises a finger. The American unscrews his tap from the pipe and a jet of water hits a guard in the back. Men gather around the guard, adding to the confusion. Hendley and two others detach themselves from the wall and head for a truck. In the hastily formed scrum of men, Hendley and another man slide under the truck. In seconds, Hendley reappears holding two long metal rods. He strides smartly towards a hut with the rods concealed under his arm. He passes them to a hand that appears through a window and resumes his lounging posture. An RAF officer smoking a pipe looks carefully around from the corner of a hut. He turns and takes the pipe from his mouth. A chap watching him picks up a book and opens it. Yet another lifts a blue cloth from the washing trough. A fourth man sees and raps on a hut wall. Inside, Danny and another man use lengths of wood to pick up and move a black stove, while a third man disconnects the chimney and reconnects it with a tin can.
In the stove, we keep fire burning always. This way the goons will not feel like moving it.
Good.
Hendley, two tiles there are chipped. We need new ones.
There's some in 113's washroom. Should match perfectly.
Good.
Danny lifts the tiled stove base from its concrete support. With a crayon, he marks the concrete. Mac watches, frowning slightly.
It's going to be a bit tricky, Danny.
Willie holds up a short-handled pickaxe.
When you're organized, Mac.
Bartlett, blue scarring around one eye very visible, strides into the room.
We're ready.
Big enough?
It's perfect. Right through the middle of the foundation.
Danny carefully writes the number 17 beside the crayon square on the concrete. Bartlett nods.
Good luck to us, Danny.
Danny, on his knees, spits on his hands, takes the pick and nods across the room. At the signal on the window, a man outside starts to hammer a metal stake into the ground. Danny waits, then matches his blows with the pick to those outside. Hendley looks at Mac.
Why 17?
This is the 17th tunnel Danny started.
Danny swings the short-handled pick into the middle of the crayon square. Night. A guard patrols the perimeter, and in a watchtower, another switches off his searchlight. In a hut, someone watches through a spy hole in the wall. Danny, in a tight vest that emphasizes his strong, square shoulders, plays with a large pebble. At a long table, men are playing chess and cards. The door opens, and Sedgwick strides through the hut.
All right, lovely.
In the shower area, Sedgwick opens his greatcoat and reveals a square slab of concrete. Danny takes it. Someone lifts a drainage grating. Danny kneels and fits the slab about a foot down the shaft beneath. It fits perfectly into a gap already cut.
It's good.
Sedgwick hands Danny a small tool, which he slips down one edge of the slab and turns. He hooks the edge of the slab, raises it, and lifts it out again.
It's very good. It's.
Danny passes the slab to someone else and springs into the shaft. With his head a foot below floor level, he reaches into the drainpipe, pulls out an improvised hammer, wraps it in a piece of cloth, and starts hammering a cold chisel into the side of the shaft. The man on lookout spots approaching guards, plugs his spy hole, and signals to a man holding a saucepan. Hearing the saucepan, Danny scrambles out, replaces the slab, and as he's rubbing dust into the cracks, the guards shove their way into the hut and towards the still open shaft.
Housey! Housemaker!
House, get out!
House, get out!
House,
get out! House,
house,
house, house, house, house, house, house.
The grating is replaced and a bucket of water sluiced down it. Danny strips, throws his clothes to Sedgwick and jumps under a shower, while Willie starts mopping the floor. Standing right on the grating, a guard stares hard at Willie.
You're not in your hut? What are you doing here?
Mopping up.
While water from the shower fills the shaft, the guard goes over to Danny.
And you?
Shower. I need a wash.
He turns to Sedgwick, leaning on a low partition.
I'm watching here. I'm a lifeguard.
House! Put on warm clothes, you might be outside all night.
Sedgwick, Danny and Willie exchange glances as the guard stomps out. When he's gone, Sedgwick chucks a towel at Danny, who grins wryly. Sedgwick strolls out, passing a guard, stripping and searching a bunk bed, then pushing the whole freestanding structure sideways and checking the floor beneath. In his cell, Virgil is counting his fingers. 14 stripes mark the wall. He stops and turns to the door.
Yes.
Fingers still extended, mouth open, he's half out of the door before turning back to pick up his coat, mitt and ball. In the corridor, the unshaven Ives joins him with a little grin. In Rams's room...
No, I vote no. Look, we put the goons to sleep exactly like you said, but just one little thing like this and we're up the creek without a paddle.
Ives, sit down, won't you?
Hello, sir.
Hello. Squadron Leader Bartlett, Captain Hilts.
Hi.
Hello. Flight Lieutenant MacDonald.
Hi, I do.
I understand you two are contemplating a blitz out.
Where'd you hear that, sir?
MacDonald, it's Mac's job to know everything that goes on.
Oh.
We thought perhaps we might talk it over.
Why? It's only two-man job.
Everybody in the camp is supposed to clear all escape attempts in advance with Squadron Leader Bartlett here. We don't necessarily want to interfere. It's just that... Well, what sort of blitz were you contemplating?
Well, we sneak out at night to a spot I found near the wire, a blind spot. Then we dig straight down, 3 feet. Take the dirt, spread it on top so it won't make a pile, and then straight out. Ives here is a tunnel man, so he digs in front, pushes the dirt behind him, and I stash it behind me. Then we just burrow right through the dirt like a couple of moles. And by dawn, we're under the wire, across the open space, into the woods, and gone.
Virgil peers at Ramsay, who glances over to Mac. Bartlett looks down for a moment, then back at Virgil.
When do you intend to try this?
Hmm?
When do you intend to try it?
Oh, tonight.
Hilts, this may not be quite the right time for this sort of thing.
Look, sir, I've been in the bag nearly 3 years now. Bloody close to being wire happy. It's a blitz out for me, forget it. It'll work. I know it will.
Ives looks up at Virgil, who gives him a gentle smile, and looks back at Ramsay, who nods to Bartlett. He in turn smiles at Virgil.
Good luck.
Thank you.
Hilts, how do you breathe?
Well, we got a steel rod with hinges on it, and we shove it up and make air holes as we go along. Good night, sir.
Ramsay, Bartlett, and Mac stare after him.
Now, why didn't anybody think of that before? It's so stupid, it's positively brilliant. But it'll bring every goon in the camp down on top of us. I don't know. Perhaps we're being too clever. If we stop all the breakouts, it may only convince the goons that we must be tunneling.
I hope it works. If it doesn't, those two are going to be in the cooler for an awful long time.
Covered with sandy-coloured soil and mud, Virgil and Ives are marched into the cooler. Ives hesitates at the cell door, and the guard shoves him in. Ives stumbles forward and stops, hands pressed flat against the walls, his face buried in the corner of the cell. In the neighbouring cell, Virgil stares first at his filthy hands, then at the cell itself, grimly resigned. Next door, Ives turns and slides to the floor, a desperate expression on his face, breathing hard, gripping and twisting his hands. The naval officer, Ashley Pitt, and Bartlett are at the mouth of the tunnel under the stove. Beneath them, Willie stabs and digs into a horizontal shaft. Another man is filling small sacks with the loose soil. Further back, Danny and Sedgwick watch.
Good, eh? Danny, it's bloody beautiful.
Sedgwick leads the way up the ladder from the shaft. Two small bags of soil are emptied onto a table.
This is the dirt from the compound.
This is from the tunnel.
A hand picks up some of the dark soil and sprinkles it onto the lighter coloured pile.
Wherever we put it, they're going to spot it a mile away.
Well, maybe we could put it under the huts. The dirt's dark there.
No, it's the first place the ferrets would look. I saw one measuring the height under a hut yesterday.
Well, maybe we could dry it out with the same colour.
We'll have 50 tons of it.
Well, I was just thinking out loud.
If you must think, for God's sake, think clearly. What the devil is Ashley Pitt? We can't destroy the dirt and we can't eat it. The only thing left to do is camouflage it. That's as far as my thinking takes me. When they teach you promptness in the RN?
You'll never believe it, but I think I have the solution.
The problem is somehow to get rid of this tunnel dirt over the compound.
Well, of course.
Would you mind?
Ashley Pitt turns to the door and slips around his neck a strip of cloth with a tubular bag hanging from either end. He turns back to the group around the table and holds up the two bags.
Now.
The bags have strings running from their lower ends.
You fill these bags
with the dirt from the tunnel. Then, wearing them inside your trousers, you wander out into the compound, where you pull these strings in your pockets.
He pulls them.
Out come the pins.
Two streams of dirt fall to the floor.
Eric, it's good.
All you have to do is kick it in. Unless you're a complete fool, the ferrets will never see a thing.
It's indecently brilliant. What do you think, Roger?
We'll try it first thing tomorrow.
I already have. It works.
Mac, this is what we'll do.
On another sunny day, prisoners, including Wing Commander Ramsay, are digging, hoeing and raking small garden plots beside their huts, watched by Mac and Bartlett. A man approaches Ramsay.
A present from Tom, sir.
Ah, thank you, Milor.
Two streams of dark earth appear by Milor's feet, and Ramsay carefully rakes the dark soil into the light earth of the compound.
Nice garden you got, sir.
Another man repeats the exercise. And another. And another. On another plot, the dark soil is scraped in with a spade. Under the command of Hendley, a squad of men perform a marching drill. At the gate, Colonel von Luger and Captain Posen return the salute of Strachwitz, who falls in with them. They stop to watch Hendley's squad.
All right, let's look sharp!
Hendley marks time as the squad passes him. He looks down and behind to check that the trickles of dark earth have been scuffed in by the marching feet.
That looks sharp!
As the commandant strolls across the compound, Ashley Pitt turns his head slightly to Ramsay.
Sir.
Von Luger holds by a garden, and the men stop working.
Please, gentlemen, continue. It is merely a routine inspection.
Mac and Bartlett watch von Luger turn stones on the dusty soil with the toe of his highly polished calf-length boot. He picks up two of the stones and wanders over to Bartlett. They exchange salutes.
Good morning, squad and leader.
Good morning, sir.
I am sorry, the soil here isn't better suited to your men's purpose.
We'll manage, sir.
Von Luger half smiles, tapping the stones together in his hands, and moves on to Ramsay.
I must say I am surprised with the extent of this activity, Group Captain. Pleased, of course, but surprised.
Surprised, Colonel?
Flyers are gentlemen, not peasants to dig in the earth. So I am surprised.
The English have always been very keen on gardening.
Oh, yes, but flowers. Is this not so?
You can't eat flowers, Colonel.
Good point.
Von Luger smiles and tosses away the stones. He salutes Ramsay and turns to his officers before leading them and the four guards past more industrious prisoners back to the gate. Ashley Pitt, Bartlett and Mac wander over to Ramsay.
You know, I have the nasty feeling he knows exactly what we're doing.
Maybe he does.
You don't really think so, do you?
He does, we'll find out soon enough.
On a grey day, puddles dot the wet, dark earth. Mac, carrying a black box, enters a hut. Inside, Hendley is screwing a latch to the cupboard door. Once in the room, Mac puts down the box and opens it.
Morning, Bob.
Andy.
Here we are. Now, let's see. Biscuits, two packets. Coffee, two tins. Bovril, one jar. Cigarettes, six packets. Strawberry jam Sorens. Blackcurrant jam Cavendish. And marmalade, mine.
Danish butter, von Luger's. I liberated it from his mess supplies.
Oh, yes, and Dutch chocolate. Two bars. Well, that cleans out the gift food for the entire organization. Now, the first thing we need is a new form of travel permit. The forgers have no idea what it looks like, and they can't move without it.
I'll see what I can do.
Oh, and of course, any other identity cards, personal papers, documents you can put your hands on. Anyway, put them to work, Bob.
Right.
Good luck.
Hendley looks thoughtfully at the chocolate. Sedgwick is staring out through a hut window. In the compound, the officer with the thick blonde moustache conducts a choir. Sedgwick starts shaping a spade with a hammer as other men hammer at bits of metal tube in front of them. A ferret wearing a darker blue uniform than the other guards walks past, glancing incuriously at the choir.
Come, let us adore him. Oh, come, let us adore him.
The door to the workshop is open to admit Mac and Bartlett.
Louis, where the hell is the air pump?
Our patience is a virtue, Roger, old
yes,
father.
I know, dear Come boy, in. But the diggers can only work when the trap's open, and this is holding us up pretty bad.
Two men move a section of wall to reveal a cavity.
Is it finished?
Of course.
Why isn't it in?
Working on the air ducts now.
Well, when will they be finished?
1 or 2 days.
Does it work?
Of course it works.
Will it give us enough air?
Quite as much as you need.
Mac?
Mac goes to the door.
Excellent.
Bartlett follows.
Have it in by tomorrow night.
Sedgwick stops pulling at the pump, and his smile fades as he looks out of the window. Hendley, a cigarette in his mouth, crosses a room to a young ferret staring out of the window.
Get a light?
Oh, yeah.
The ferret lights Hendley's cigarette.
Excellent. It's pretty, isn't it?
Yes.
Hendley blows his cigarette smoke under the nose of the ferret, who sniffs it appreciatively.
Oh, I'm sorry. Would you like one?
The ferret looks around cautiously.
I'll smoke it later when I'm off duty, thank you.
Yeah, you probably have a couple of roommates, huh?
Hendley gives him two more.
Beautiful day.
Yes, but I think it might rain later.
No, no. Red sky in the morning, sailor takes warning. Red sky at night, sailor's delight. It's the red sky last night.
Never heard that before.
I learned it in the Boy Scouts.
You were a Boy Scout?
Mm-hmm.
So was I.
Really?
Yes, I had 19 merit badges.
I had 20.
Oh, I was working on my 20th when the government abolished scouting and sent me into the Hitler Youth instead.
Hey, Werner. You think you'll stay in the army after the war?
Oh, no. No, I'm not a well man. My teeth.
Your teeth?
Yes. Ah, I could tell you stories about my teeth that would make your hair stand on end. Our dentist here is a butcher. But don't tell anyone I said so.
It's a soldier's right to complain.
Maybe in your army, but here, one little criticism and zhit to the Russian front.
Is that so? Terrible. That's terrible.
Hendley wanders back into the room, frowning.
Werner.
Werner follows him.
Why don't we go into my room where we can talk more comfortably, huh?
I'd better not. If Strawitz should see me.
I was just going to make some coffee.
Werner stiffens.
Some real coffee.
Hendley walks over to the door. Werner hesitates and looks round nervously. He turns and, with one final look over his shoulder, passes through the door Hendley's holding open. Once Hendley is inside the room, Werner closes the door. Hendley unlocks a padlock and opens the cupboard door. He starts removing the stash given him by Mac, placing packets and jars on the table behind him.
Coffee, coffee, coffee.
Marmalade, it is ja wunderbar.
My grandmother keeps sending me this stuff.
He puts the two big chocolate bars on the table.
Oh, du lieber, I got chocolate.
Oh, yeah, here, take one.
Hendley thrusts one of them at Werner. Suddenly, Werner reaches forward and picks up the tin of Danish butter.
It's ja von Luger's butter.
Yeah, keep it.
Nein, I must go.
You work over here. It's okay, you can keep it, we're friends.
With you in the cooler, will we still be friends? I must report this.
I don't understand you, Werner. Report what? That you and I were chatting in my room?
I must go.
Oh, here, it's okay. Look, keep it. I'll never be able to eat it all. I've got
all I can eat.
Oh, I'm sorry. All right, forget it.
Hendley stops trying to push the chocolate into Werner's pocket, and the German goes. Hendley stands there holding the chocolate. After a moment, he moves away from the door. From under the chocolate bar, he takes a brown wallet and begins removing the contents. Money and an identity card with a photo of Werner. Hendley grins happily. Colin is standing in front of a blackboard with a beautiful drawing of a bird.
And that, I'm sure you'll all remember, is the voice of Benelli's Warbler. Now, let's turn our attention to this gentleman, the masked shrike, Lanius Nubicus, the butcher bird. The shrike impales his foes on the spikes of thorn bushes. Not a very lovable character, you see. Let's have a look at the colouring. Uniform black above, from head to tail. A black rump, a black crown with a bold white flash and a white line over the eye. The shrike lives in likely wooded country. Ah, Hendley, sit down. You'll find drawing materials on the table. The shrike lives in likely wooded country, in olive groves and gardens.
Well, Hendley, have you taken to birds too now?
Shrike.
Yeah, you should stick around. You might learn something.
Well, I've better things to do than draw birds.
In flight. The voice is a monotonous succession of scratchy, complaining notes. Now, let's have a good look at this bird. You see, he's got a good round shape.
The ferret leaves the hut, watched by a man leaning against some dustbins. Another chap taps a pipe into his hand, and the dustbin man moves a lid from one bin to the next. A third man taps on the hut wall. Inside, Colin sits and takes papers from under a plank of the table. Mac and Bartlett come up beside him.
An Urlaubschein. Permission to cross a frontier.
Yeah.
There's another one. Which one's a forgery?
That one.
That's right.
They both are. What's holding us up now is the new form of this travel permit. We've no idea what they look like.
Here's one.
Hendley hands over papers from the wallet.
And a military identity card. And
An Ausweis.
Yeah.
Permission to be on Reich property.
A ticket to Odin. What appears to be the ferret assignments by day and hour for the next week.
You get 10 out of 10 for this, old boy.
Thank you, sir. Take good care of that.
Where did you get this?
It's on loan.
Griff's wearing a uniform jacket.
Now, in order to get the right amount of outfits, Roger, I suggest that we work mainly from service uniforms. Now, I can do double-breasteds, single-breasteds, and rather nice lounge suits. Lapels. Now, I can do quite a lot of things with those. I can have them deep like that, or high ones like that.
Mm-hmm.
Ah, here's one that we're working on right now.
Oh, yes. What about buttons?
Just take a look at those. Here's one that I finished, Roger.
He hands Roger a smart blue jacket.
And here's one that I dyed with a bottle of blue ink. That's rather good. What's that, Roger?
I was just thinking the goons would have a field day if they crashed in on this lot.
Oh, that's Sorin's department. Now, I've started working on the other materials. This blanket, particularly the striped, marvellous. Coats.
Yes?
I've got the chaps working on these all over the compound. Oh, those battle dresses, I'm afraid they're a bit too short. I'll have to get the chaps to make those into some sort of working man's outfits.
Mm-hmm.
Blanket ticking. Now, I've made these into rather nice little waistcoats.
Ah, very definitely, yes. Dyed, of course.
Of course. Just take a look at this, Roger. Now, this blanket material, we scrape this down until it's really smooth, and then dye it with boot polish. Corduroy, scrounged by Hendley. Yes, I wish we had more of this.
Where in God's name did you get these from?
Hendley.
Well, where did he get them?
Well, I asked him that.
What did he say?
Don't ask. Now, let me show you some of the overcoats I've been working on.
Bartlett drops the two full bolts of cloth. The door of the cooler opens. Virgil and Ives emerge, squinting into the sun. Virgil nods at Ives, and they head for the gate. In the compound, they stop for a moment. Virgil looks round, smiling, and takes a deep breath. Ives looks tense, and when they move off, he's holding his arms stiffly at his side. Other men watch silently. In a hut, Mac and Bartlett are sitting at a table, drinking from tin mugs. Virgil enters.
Morning, Hilt.
Uh-oh. Well, if you're here to find out if I'm going out again, I am.
When?
17 days, 7th of July.
Dark of the moon.
Correct.
Is Ives going with you?
Yeah, if he wants to.
You know that Ives is close to cracking?
Yeah. Figure it's better for him to go out in the tunnel, huh?
Safer.
Virgil goes to a bench and picks up a mug and a tin jug. He looks back at the other two.
Right. Hiltz, it's possible, of course, for one man to get out through the wire, even get away, but there are, in fact, a considerable number of people besides yourself in this camp who are trying to escape.
I appreciate that.
Still holding the jug, Virgil goes and leans against the door.
Something's coming. I can feel it, and it's coming right around the corner at me, squadron leader.
My name's Roger.
All right, Roger.
Yours is Virgil, isn't it?
Hiltz. J.
Just make it Hiltz. Yes, well, as I was saying, Hiltz, we have maps of Germany, general maps, that is. In fact, we have all the information that we need for the escape routes out of Germany. But what we do not have
is a clear idea of what's 500 yards beyond those trees.
Right.
We've tried every goon in the camp, no go.
We must know the exact position of the local town. We want to know where we hit the main roads. They must patrol them. Where the local police stations are. Where they've got their military roadblocks. And most important of all, we've got to know how to get from here to the railway station.
No, absolutely not. When I get through that wire, I'm not going to be peeking over fences making maps for you guys. By morning, I'm going to be so far away you couldn't hear it if they were shooting at me with howitzers. Hmm?
That's understandable. Completely.
I mean, I'd like to help, but...
Virgil goes over to the bench, then turns back to them.
Interesting idea. How many are you taking out?
250.
250?
Yeah.
You're crazy. You ought to be locked up. You too. 250 guys just walking down the road, just like that.
Well, some on the road, some by train, some cross-country.
They'll have forged papers, clothes, maps, compasses, rations.
Has it occurred to you that you're going to alert every goon in the country? Anybody that can carry a pitchfork is going to be out looking for you? Why, they're going to swoop down and scoop you up so fast it'd make your head swim.
Bartlett and Mac glance at each other and get up.
Yes, well, thanks anyway.
Anything I can do to help you out in the tunnel, just let me know.
Well, that's very good of you.
Anytime. Wait a minute. You aren't seriously suggesting that if I get through the wire and case everything out there and don't get picked up, to turn myself in and get thrown back in the cooler for a couple of months so you can get the information you need?
Yes. One has to ask some very strange things in the job I have.
We'll give you a front place in the tunnel.
I wouldn't do that for my own mother.
I don't blame you.
Well, okay, then.
Well, it's completely understandable.
Well, okay, then.
Yes, well, thanks, Hiltz.
Virgil stares after them. In their room, Hendley's playing chess with Colin, who's also making tea.
Check.
Colin looks up indignantly as Werner enters.
Hendley, I...
Oh, it's all right. Blythe's a friend.
Werner edges suspiciously past Colin.
What's the matter, Werner?
My wallet, my papers, my identity card. Gun. I lost them. Everything.
He lost his wallet. Do you realize what would happen if Strachwitz found this out?
Zit.
The Russian front.
There.
Werner beckons Hendley closer.
I've looked every place. Every place. I must have lost them while I was in here.
No.
Yes.
Look, I told you we were friends. We'll find them.
Oh, thank you, Hendley.
Werner, not now. It might look a little peculiar if you and I were seen probing around at this time of night.
Oh.
Look, I'll find them. I promise you I'll find them if I have to tear this room apart.
Werner sidles back to the door, smiling gratefully.
Thank you.
Forget it. Werner.
Yes?
There is one small favor. A camera.
Werner's smile disappears.
We want to take some snapshots, you know. Keepsake. 35 millimeter with 2.8 lens and a plane shutter.
Focal plane shutter.
Werner, that's a focal plane shutter. Let me know when you got it.
Hearing another door, Werner disappears.
A crazy mixed-up kid, that Werner. Well, I like him.
Checkmate.
Colin smiles up at the frowning Hendley. In the dark of the narrow tunnel, Willie is lying on his side, manoeuvring a scoop fashioned from a large tin to empty soil from it into a box. Twisting onto his back, he lifts the box onto a trolley behind him. He raps on the trolley. And at the foot of the shaft, Danny hauls it in. Behind Danny, Bartlett's watching Sedgwick at work.
How soon's that air pump going to be ready?
Oh, I'll have it for you tomorrow, Roger.
You're badly behind schedule, Sedgwick, old copper. How's it coming, Danny?
No good.
No good?
Today, three times.
Falling earth buries Willie. Danny leaps face down onto the trolley and frantically pulls himself hand over hand along the tunnel. Reaching Willie's legs, he yanks him free of the earth and lifts his head. Behind him, Sedgwick and Bartlett haul the trolley back and lift Willie off it. Bartlett wipes Willie's mouth and nose free of earth, and Danny puts a water canteen to his lips. Bartlett checks that Willie's airways are clear and relaxes slightly.
We're up the whole bloody tunnel, Roger. All 335 feet of it.
Four times to be.
This way we never get through. We must have more wood.
It's a lot of timber, Roger. Can you get it?
We'll get it. We've got to get it. I'll put Henley on it. And the new man we got this morning. Okay, Willie.
On the first day of Christmas, my true love sent to me a partridge in a pear tree.
Henley tugs planks from a wall, hands them to another man, then covers the gaps with a cupboard. In the sunny compound, a scowling ferret hesitates before walking on past the choir. The moustachioed conductor watches him go. Inside, Henley and three more men gaze up into the roof.
On the fifth day of Christmas, my true love sent to me 5 gold rings.
How's it going with the rafters up there?
Taking out 24.
More lengths of timber are handed down, and Henley passes them to his team.
Stay with it.
Virgil reaches under a bunk bed and removes every second plank. He adds them to a double stack already on the table, with the ends just overhanging the corner. He looks at the stack, sighs, and repeats the process with another bunk, adding the planks to the stack. Bracing himself, he bends at the knees, slips his arms beneath the ends of the stack, and carefully lifts it. He can barely see over the top. He starts slowly towards the door, and the conductor strides past him.
5 gold rings, 4 calling birds,
bloody singing I never worked so hard in all my life. I'll see Cavendish.
Cavendish leaps onto the top bunk Virgil has just finished with. Cavendish crashes through both bunks and stares up from the floor at Virgil, who shrugs.
Never mind.
Virgil goes, leaning back under the weight of the planks. Cavendish doesn't move. Henley marches into a hut and hands Colin a camera.
It's a present from our friend Werner.
Splendid. Simply splendid. This should do very nicely.
Henley looks up in alarm as the ceiling bends.
There's Ashley Pitt's man. He requested permission to dispose of some of his dirt in our attic.
The ceiling sags and sways, and Henley leaves quickly. In the tunnel, Danny eases himself face down onto the trolley. In one hand, he holds a big spindle, thickly wound with white tape. Using his free hand, he hauls himself along the tunnel, the tape from the spindle stretching out behind him. The trolley runs on a track of boards. Candles mounted every few yards along the wall light up the wooden shuttering which protects the tunnel from cave-ins. They also light the coloured marker knots tied onto the tape at regular intervals. Danny passes a cutting on one side of the tunnel where tools are stacked, checks the tape behind him and presses on, the candles casting alternate light and shadow on his muscular olive skin. Beside pipework for the air pump sits Cavendish, a pencil in his mouth. A plumb bob hangs from the roof, a length of string weighted by a stone. Cavendish takes the spindle, pulls it tight, and marks off the point beneath the plumb line. Watched by Danny and a third man, he makes a note on a scrap of paper. Ramsay, Bartlett, Cavendish and Mac stand near the fence.
Tom has reached just beyond that pile of woods in the Vorlager. Harry, of course, isn't as far as that.
How much further to the trees?
We make it 50 feet, sir. Dark of the Moon is the 7th...
8th and 9th.
8th and 9th, mm.
Dearly in August.
Yeah.
Bartlett takes a step towards the fence. Ramsay spots Virgil and his American friend wheeling two little barrows full of potatoes.
There he goes again.
Why is he buying up all the potatoes in the camp?
I've been working on that, but I can't find out. Wilson and Henley lock themselves in the room every night. Sometimes Goff's in there with them. Other nights he's in guard outside.
Mac, we'll close down Dick and Harry. Seal them off.
Put the entire effort into Tom and press right on into the trees.
Right, Roger.
Night. Virgil's friend Goff lugs two sacks along a hut corridor. Virgil opens up, yanks him in from the corridor, and swiftly locks up again. Six brooms with white handles lean against the wall of the dimly lit room. Goff and Virgil empty potatoes from the sacks into two wicker baskets. Next to them, Hendley stands watching intently over a complicated arrangement of pipes, which lead away from a big, steaming pot. Virgil, mincing potatoes into a battered tin bowl, suddenly looks up. He, Hendley and Goff move around the table and bend down to stare at the end of the pipe, suspended over a cloth filter covering another bowl. As they watch, a clear fluid trickles from the pipe. Virgil sticks a finger into the stream and sucks it.
Wow.
Hendley does likewise.
Wow.
Goff uses three fingers.
Wow.
Hendley slaps Virgil on the back and they return to their tasks with even greater urgency. Hendley hefts a big jar in a wicker basket, shakes it, removes the stopper, and lifting it on his shoulder, carefully pours liquid into a small tin cup held by Virgil, who swirls it and takes a swig. He swills it round his mouth before swallowing.
Whoa.
He passes the cup to Hendley, who sips, screws up his face, and passes it to Goff, who gives the others a manly look before sampling the brew. Virgil rescues the cup, and Hendley solemnly bangs the stopper back in the bottle. In early morning light, Virgil flicks on his lighter inside a dustbin, claps on the lid, and steps away, fingers in his ears. Hendley looks over and grins as he raises a battered Stars and Stripes up a sapling flagpole. A few men appear, some still in their pyjamas, and wander across the compound towards the table, where Hendley, Virgil and Goff raise tin canteens to their mouths, swallow and blink hard. Goff ties a blood-stained strip of bandage around his head. Virgil dons a black waistcoat and takes out a wooden flute. Hendley straps a drum around his waist, and with Goff in the centre carrying another Stars and Stripes, the three of them stand to attention.
About
a large and growing band of prisoners follows the three Americans around the camp.
What is it? Well, they're celebrating the revolution. It's the 4th of July.
Ashley Pitt, Willie, Danny and several others from their hut join the crowd, and Sedgwick hops barefoot out of a hut window. Mac, Bartlett and Ramsey emerge from another hut.
Devil's it.
The Americans come to attention in front of them.
Gentlemen, you're invited for free drinks at the wash stand.
It's the 4th of July, a little present from the Colonial.
Down the British.
Yeah, yeah.
Quite right, too.
And a little drink to Tom.
And to getting home.
Thank you. Very well, we accept.
Up the rebels.
Down the British.
Gentlemen, if you care to follow us, how about... Hey!
Hello, now. Hard!
The crowd makes way for them. Colin comes out of his hut holding his tin cup, puts on his cap and joins in, smiling. The Americans lead a big crowd back to the washstand, where more prisoners have already gathered under the fluttering Stars and Stripes.
All right, let's line up now.
Strachwitz holsters his pistol. With two ferrets, Strachwitz watches the cheerful crowd, each getting a tot of moonshine, in a variety of cups, bowls, pots and pans.
That explains what happened to the potatoes.
No harm in floating down Tom for one day, Roger. I suppose it'll do us all good to let off a bit of steam. There's only 14 feet to go, sir, and you can feel it throughout the whole bloody camp.
Well, I think that calls for a drink.
Here he is, sir.
Drink it up.
Moonshine. American moonshine. Moonshine.
Up there, up there.
I'm a star scout. Cheers, Henry.
Here we go. Here we go. Keep it moving now.
Keep it going. Good morning.
Hello, Eric.
Don't spill any of that. Good morning, there you go.
Hey, hello, Eric. Down with the British.
All right, old comer. Yeah. Keep it up. Don't.
Yeah. Don't get any on your clothes.
Cheers.
Don't get any on your clothes.
Thank you.
There you go. Don't spill any of that.
Before your morning tea.
Tonic water.
Here, keep it moving.
Don't get any on your clothes, sir.
Yeah, down
American moonshine.
Don't smoke right after you drink.
Come on, hurry up.
No smoking. No smoking while you're drinking.
Prisoners spread across the compound with their drinks, perching on upturned oil drums and benches around a square pool. While Virgil pours from a jar under each arm, Goff continues drinking from his canteen and pouring some of the contents down Virgil's throat.
Get good and strong, my friend.
Keep it going. Keep it.
No taxation without representation.
Keep it going, boys. Keep it. Keep it going, fellas. Enjoy yourself.
Huh? Let's drink to Tom.
Mac and Bartlett raise a mug and a small pan, respectively, to Ramsay's toast.
Oi. In the 3 years, 7 months of approximately 2 weeks that I've been in the bag, that's the most extraordinary stuff I've ever tasted. Oh, it's shattering.
I think it's rather good.
Mac takes another deep swig.
Well, with your permission, sir, I think I'll all unkive. Colonize.
Bartlett's mouth is open as he watches Mac go. Hendley walks through the crowd, being toasted by everyone he passes and raising his mug to them in return. He sits beside Colin on a bench with several other men, who all toast him. Colin's wearing a battle-dress jacket and his ankles stick out from under his nightshirt. Hendley lifts his big tin mug to his lips and turns to Colin.
You know what that is?
I'll tell you what, it isn't. It isn't Napoleon brandy.
Virgil walks up to Ramsay and Bartlett.
How do you like it, sir?
Well, it's,
To the colonies.
Independent.
They all drink, and Ramsay stares into the sky, lips moving silently for a moment.
How are you managing over there without us? Getting along all right, are you?
We seem to be getting along all right, sure, sir.
He looks at Bartlett, who smiles and nods before looking down at his small tin pan.
Yes, well, it's, it's good stuff, Hiltz.
Thank you, sir.
Virgil smiles at them and goes. Strachwitz leads Werner and another ferret through a hut, checks that one of the rooms is empty and walks briskly in. He stands by the stove covering the tunnel shaft. Outside, Danny leans against the hut wall, frowning slightly. Willie brings him a mug.
Danny? Yes, sir.
Danny nods towards the hut. Inside, the officer sits on the bunk next to the stove and looks grimly at the two ferrets.
Roger. Goons in 105.
Oh.
Strachwitz.
Well, we'd have to ignore it. If we pay any attention, the goons will know that's important. Mr. Gillingham.
Bartlett sips again from his pan. In the hut, Strachwitz shifts his position slightly, reaches behind him, and pulls out the two boards cut and shaped to lift the hot stove. He's about to put them aside, but looks again at the shaping, then at the stove.
Come on, Danny. I've searched it 100 times. Home.
Bartlett sips again. Strachwitz thoughtfully pushes the boards back under the grey blanket and moves back to the door. Outside, Mac is with Ives.
Anyway, I'm glad we've got you in the tunnel with us, Piglet.
Aye.
To Tom, eh?
Ives, still looking anxious, doesn't drink.
Oh, never mind. You'll be walking down Argyle Street in a couple of weeks, man.
To Tom. You know, Sandy, I'm just beginning to realise that myself.
Why shouldn't you, man? We're nearly at the trees, boy. We're nearly at the trees, eh?
Others turn to watch the two of them, arms linked, dancing round each other. In the hut, Werner, pouring from a jug on the stove, looks up. He puts the jug back on the stove, but drops the hot tin cup, shaking his burnt hand. The liquid runs away between the tiles the stove is standing on. Werner bends to look more closely, takes the jug again, and pours more liquid onto the tiles. Again, it disappears.
Help it! Help it! Help it!
In the compound, heads turn. Inside, Werner shows Strachwitz the trick. Strachwitz pushes Werner aside, grabs the shaped planks, and knocks off the stove chimney. With the other ferret, he moves the stove. He runs his fingers over the tiles. In the compound, all eyes are on the hut. With a penknife, Strachwitz prizes up one tile. The other ferret runs out. Strachwitz opens the shaft. Mac and Ives freeze, staring at the hut. Hendley looks up from his canteen.
Oh, my God, they found Tom.
Mac starts to run, followed by a few men nearby. Ives, a frozen look on his face, moves very slowly a few paces and stops. A squad of armed guards comes through the gates at a run. Hendley stares at them.
It's the tunnel.
As Ashley Pitt moves, the guards surround Hut 105, rifles at the ready. Ives stares, swallows, and starts walking very slowly, eyes fixed on something ahead. Hendley covers his eyes with his hand. Ives is still walking with the shambling gait and staring eyes of a man in a trance, his arms not moving, his mouth slightly open. He stops when he reaches the warning wire and drops the little billy can he's been holding. Virgil starts running just as Ives sprints for the wire and starts climbing. Virgil kicks one guard to the ground before he can shoot. Another knocks him down with his rifle butt, and a guard in the watchtower opens fire. Ives's body sags and falls back, hanging on the wire. Prisoners run towards the fence and stop a few yards back from it, staring up at Ives. Virgil slowly rises into a kneeling position, arms clutching his stomach where the guard hit him. He looks up as one of Ives's arms falls free of the barbed wire, leaving him hanging by the other. Virgil stands, still staring up. He glances down and begins to walk slowly forward. He steps over the warning wire, staring straight into the eyes of a guard pointing a rifle at him. With the rifle barrel almost touching his chest, he bends down and picks up Ives's cap. Looking up at Ives again, he holds the cap between both hands as if in prayer. He turns, picks up the billy can, and walks back to Bartlett.
Sir, let me know the exact information you need. I'm going out tonight.
Right.
They both look back at the fence.
Open up, Harry. We dig. Around the clock.
Night. Lights on the outside walls of the huts cast only a faint glow through the compound, and the occasional splash from the searchlights is rapidly swallowed up in the gloom. A figure flickers across open ground and falls to earth at the foot of the fence. Cutters start snipping through the wire. Day. In bright sunshine, a ferret and guard stand near the fence. Lying in a narrow tunnel, Danny digs with short, stabbing thrusts. He puts an arm over his head as earth falls from the roof and looks up nervously before continuing. Behind him, Willie, lying on his side, passes a small sack to a man lying on his back behind him, who lifts it back over his head to another man, and so on along a chain of six, to men with enough headroom to sit as they move the steady flow of sacks up the incline towards the mouth of the tunnel. Outside the fence, a grey open-topped car pulls up. In the front sit two guards, in the back, one guard and Virgil. The gate is opened. Virgil leaves the car, and with his boots around his neck and his flying jacket in one hand, he walks briskly into the compound. He chucks aside the jacket and puts his hands on his head so that Strachwitz can frisk him. Virgil looks over to the watching Bartlett and gives him a very slight nod. Strachwitz returns his jacket.
Cooler.
Right.
Virgil strides away.
Well, I didn't think they'd catch him so soon.
He wasn't caught.
Ramsay, still limping and leaning on his stick, joins other prisoners who have come to watch Virgil disappear into the cooler. He marches past them all, looking straight ahead. Goff is waiting by the gate.
Helt, welcome home.
Goff lobs the baseball mitt, which Virgil catches one-handed. He glances at Goff without a smile as he enters the cooler compound. Inside the gloomy grey cooler, Virgil waits for a guard to unlock a cell and walks straight in. He tosses his jacket aside, leans against the wall beside the door, slides down into a sitting position, throws the baseball against the opposite wall and catches it in the mitt. The young guard watches for a moment before locking up. Virgil smiles. Danny, glistening with sweat, is lying flat in the tunnel. He looks up, turns, and starts to scramble back. He disappears under earth and timber. Willie peers along the tunnel.
Danny?
The earth heaves.
Danny?
Danny slowly emerges, crawling back on his elbows.
Danny?
Face contorted with effort, Danny hauls himself clear of the earth.
Are you all right, Danny?
Danny's lying flat on his back.
Yes. All right.
He pulls himself onto his side.
All right. Bring some shovels, I'm all right.
Colin stares at a document.
For God's sake, Smithy, you've left out a whole bloody eagle.
That's impossible.
Colin grabs a seal and inspects it.
Yes.
He looks again through his magnifying glass.
4 days' work up the bloody spout.
The young man crumples.
I'm sorry, Colin. It's all right, Smithy.
Colin holds his watch up to one eye.
It's getting late. You push off to bed, I'll pack up here. Right. Good night, Colin. Good night, Smithy.
Colin straightens the crumpled paper, stares at it, picks up the magnifying glass, looks through it, twists the glass round, and looks again. He puts the glass down. He peers at the paper, brings it closer to his eyes. The photo of Max swims out of focus. He gazes around the room, looks down at his watch, then brings it close to his face. He looks up again, stricken.
I can't see a bloody thing.
Mac looks through a German identity document, then at the man on the other side of the desk.
Hut ab.
The man in civilian clothes takes off his cap.
Sehr gut, in Ordnung. Dankeschön.
Bitte schön.
Herein.
In Luftwaffe uniform, another man comes forward.
Heil Hitler.
He hands over a document.
Wie heißen Sie?
Erik Stressel, aus München.
Warum sind Sie hier?
Ich habe Urlaub bekommen. Ich gehe nach München und besuche meine kranke Mutter.
Your German's very good.
Oh, thanks, Mac. I've put in a lot of...
Oh, now watch it, Haynes. It's the easiest way in the world to trip up a suspect. Don't fall for that old gag.
Sorry, Mac.
Okay, but remember, German always.
Right on.
Herein.
Goff comes forward. In his room, Colin, in civvies, feels something between his fingers without looking at it. He moves to the door, turns his back to it, and feels for the handle. He walks across the room. He kicks the wall below the shuttered window, bends over, and puts something down. He walks backwards to the door, then strolls across the room, head down, as if looking at the thing on the floor, and bends to pick it up. He stands quickly and turns.
Roger.
Hendley frowns. He leans against the door with arms folded.
No, it's me.
How do you like the old escape suit?
Fine. Carla.
He takes off his uniform cap.
How do you like mine?
That looks splendid.
Colin rolls back on his bunk. Hendley, in full uniform, slings his cap onto the top bunk, strolls over and leans against it. Night. A figure holding something in one hand sprints from the shadow of one hut to the shadow of the next. He moves again, flattening himself against another hut wall. A glimmer of light falls on Danny's strong cheekbones and thick hair. He looks back.
Danny, where are you going? You'll get yourself shot. What's the matter with you?
I'm going out. That fence.
He breaks away. Willie follows.
Danny, we're getting out through the tunnel. We're almost clear.
Please, Willie, let me alone. I can't go in that tunnel anymore. So I'm going out through the wire.
He shoves Willie aside, but Willie grabs him again.
Danny, think. We're getting out, but not through the wire. We're getting out through the tunnel. It's finished.
I go out now.
He hits Danny.
You go through that wire and you'll get killed.
Danny drags Willie into deeper shadow and threatens him with his cutters for a moment.
Don't do that. Willie. Since I was a boy, I hate and feared little rooms, closets, okay, Danny.
You dug 17 tunnels, over 17
because
tunnels.
Because I must get out. I hide the fear, and I dig. But tomorrow night in the tunnel with all those men, I'm afraid maybe this time I will lose my head and ruin the escape for everybody. So I go now.
He moves. Willie trips him, jumps on top of him, and drags him back to the hut wall.
Danny, I'll see you through the tunnel. I'll look after you. I'll stick with you all the way.
Right.
They sprint back the way they came. Colin and Hendley are lying on their bunks.
Good evening.
Hello, Roger.
Colin stands.
Well, how do you think we look? Guten Abend, mein Herr, wie geht es Ihnen?
That's as bad as all that. Colin, I want first of all to say that without you, we would not have been ready. Oh, that's all right. I had lots of help. Lots of very good help. What's the matter, Roger?
You can't go.
Hendley sits up.
What do you mean?
I can't allow it.
Why?
Because you can't see your hand in front of your face. You'd be caught before you got 10 yards.
That's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. Never heard anything so absurd in my life. I can see perfectly. I can see perfectly. I can see that pin down there. Does that satisfy you?
What pin? Where?
Colin walks from the door to the window, where he bends to pick something up. Bartlett sits on Colin's bunk.
Colin, do you see the foot of the door?
Yes, of course.
Bartlett sticks his leg out.
Put the pin down there, will you?
All right.
Bartlett catches Colin as he trips over the outstretched leg.
All right, come on. Come on, sit down. Sit down. It was a good try. I hate these last-minute letdowns, but I've only just been told. It's too risky for you.
Don't you think that's Colin's decision?
No, I don't.
Come on, Roger. We all know the score here. Or at least, most of us do. Your idea of this escape is to start another front, to foul up the Germans behind the lines. All right, that's fine, that's fine. But once we get past that barbed wire, once we have them looking all over Germany for us, that mission is accomplished. Afterwards, we have some ideas of our own.
You mean getting home? Back to your family and children?
That's right.
Good God, man, do you really believe I haven't thought about that, too?
I'm sure you have. I know Colin has. And Roger, I have, too. We think we can make it all the way.
Not Colin. He'd be an appalling hazard to the whole escape. That must be my decision.
Don't you want to talk about hazard? Let's talk about hazard. Let's talk about you. You're the biggest hazard we have. The Gestapo has you marked. No one has said you can't go.
That's true. And I have thought about the Gestapo. But if you're asking me how far a commanding officer is allowed to go, or dare go, or should be permitted to play God, I can't answer you. But I can tell you, a blind man is an unnecessary hazard, not only to himself, but to the whole plan, and must therefore be eliminated from the operation.
Hendley looks down at Colin, sitting miserably on his bunk.
Colin's not a blind man as long as he's with me. And he's going with me.
Colin turns his head towards Hendley.
It's all right with you, Colin?
Quiet.
Very well. I'll arrange for your escape numbers to be altered accordingly. Good night, General.
Hendley opens the door for Bartlett.
Actually, he's quite right. He's completely right. I really shouldn't go at all. My eyes have been getting worse and worse lately. I think they call it progressive myopia.
I can see things up here. Close to, I can see to work. But, you're just a blur.
I know. Oh, hell, we'll make it in great shape. Colin, do you have any tea?
Yes, of course.
Then let's have some.
Splendid.
Colin walks slowly over to a shelf and carefully feels for his tins. In the cooler, Virgil is sitting on the floor of the bare cell. He stands expectantly, watching the door. Outside it, Strachwitz waits for a guard to unlock.
House.
Virgil picks up his ball and mitt, walks to the door, and looks up at the very tall Strachwitz for a moment before striding out of the block. Outside, in the sunshine, Mac is sitting reading. He looks up as he sees Virgil crossing the compound, still tossing the ball into his mitt.
Hi, Hill.
Hey, Mac.
Virgil walks over to him.
When?
Tonight? I thought they'd never let you up.
Me too. Let's get at it.
Bartlett's waiting for you.
I'll be there.
Virgil strides away, and Mac retreats into his hut. Guards amble past the huts in the shadowy light, glimpsed for a moment before disappearing into the dark again. In a watchtower, a guard turns on his searchlight and swings it slowly across the compound, along the fence, and back again. Bartlett, in a dark civilian suit, watches from a hut window. He looks at his watch. Behind him, Ashley Pitt, sitting on a bench, does the same, while another man fiddles with a pencil. Sitting alone, long legs splayed before him, Sedgwick glances at his watch and leans back against the hut wall. In the tunnel, Danny, in a leather jacket and a cap, sits tensely holding a coil of rope. Willie is sitting to his left. Virgil is squatting in the tunnel, with tree roots dangling from above, holding a short-handled spade. Danny turns to Willie.
Only 8 minutes now, Danny.
Danny nods, blinking rapidly.
You okay?
Danny nods again. Above ground, three figures in civilian clothes flit round a corner and into a hut.
Cavendish. Crick. Down there. Golf.
The three go to the bunks indicated by the holder of the list. Outside, more men dart into the shadow of a hut, avoiding the wandering searchlight beam. The distinctively tall, square-jawed figure of Hendley is amongst them. They too enter the hut, Hendley shepherding Colin ahead of him.
Smith, Foles, third on the right. Clyde, Hendley, third on the left.
Hendley follows Colin through the dimly lit hut, and after a few paces, puts his hands on Colin's shoulders and steers him to the left. They reach a pair of bunks. Hendley hops onto the top and lounges back, weight on one elbow, and Colin slowly sits on the lower one. In the tunnel, Virgil gently probes the earth above his head with the spade, and a trickle of soil falls. Danny glances at Willie and away again, shutting his eyes tight. As he does so, electric lights come on.
There are the lights. Right on the tick, Danny.
Willie checks his watch, and Danny leans forward to blow out a candle. He leans back, eyes shut.
Look down the tunnel, Danny. It's lovely. No, it's just like Blackpool, the height of the season. You ever been at Blackpool, Danny?
Yes. No. I don't know.
In a hut, Mac opens a door.
It's time, Roger.
Bartlett nods at Ramsay, who's still in RAF uniform, and goes to the door. They walk down the corridor to the man with the list.
Bartlett, McDonald, Ashley Pitt.
At the other end of the hut, someone checks before opening the door for them.
It's all clear, sir.
The three of them move quickly through the shadow and into the open door of the next hut. As the door closes, a searchlight beam lights the gap they've just crossed.
All set, Roger.
Bartlett walks down the centre of a hut full of men in civilian clothes, glancing from side to side. Sitting by a small reading lamp is Sedgwick, who takes Bartlett's briefcase as he lets himself down into the shaft. Sedgwick leans forward.
Roger. Good luck.
Bartlett nods, unsmiling, and lowers himself into the shaft. Mac and Ashley Pitt follow. As Mac settles himself below ground, he gives the air pump, like a long tubular bellows, a few pushes. He passes Bartlett's case to him, takes his own, and gathers up a coil of rope. Bartlett lies face down on a small trolley and wraps on it with a trowel. Mac shoves the trolley down the tunnel and pays out the rope. Virgil pushes his spade upwards. Danny nervously rubs his hands on his trousers.
I'll be coming down the shaft now, Danny. And then they'll be coming right up the tunnel.
Danny looks down the tunnel, lit by dim bulbs every few yards.
Really, I can't wait till it's open. I must get up. Danny! 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 Danny!
Willie scrambles along the tunnel after Danny. Virgil drops down from his position just below ground into the tunnel proper and peers along it. Further back, Bartlett reaches the man who has been hauling his trolley, rolls off that trolley and onto another. He raps on it as before. He looks up in alarm at Danny, who's coming from the opposite direction.
Is it Danny? What's the matter?
Must
Danny,
have
from here!
Roger, Roger. Danny and I'll go later. We'll take another place.
Danny, tell me what this is and tell me quickly.
This tunnel is mine as much as anybody. I dug it. I built it. I was buried many times. I go when I want. Let me out. Let me out.
Take him out, Willie.
Roger.
Take him out.
Willie follows Danny, now on the trolley that Bartlett arrived on, and Bartlett mounts his again. Grim-faced, he rolls on down the long tunnel. In the hut, Sedgwick leans forward as Danny emerges.
Danny, what is it?
Danny, what? What's going on?
It's all right, Sedgwick, it's all right. We're going late.
Danny looks around briefly as if to get his bearings, then heads for a door. Willie joins him.
Danny, it's all right. It's all right. We can take another place in the line. It's all right.
All right, Colin. Down you go. Now sit down. Feel the top rung of the ladder with your right foot. Down, yeah. Huh? Down you go.
Hendley pulls on a light grey trilby and slips down the ladder behind Colin. He takes his case from Sedgwick and disappears. Two more men follow. Virgil hauls Bartlett's trolley to the end of the tunnel and helps him off.
Danny cut out, huh?
We need to get him up top.
He looks on you.
Bartlett looks in surprise as Virgil scrambles up again. He turns and raps on the trolley. Virgil pushes his spade into the roof. At the other end of the tunnel, Hendley does his turn on the air pump as Colin settles on the trolley.
Remember, keep your head down. Right.
Hendley raps on the trolley and Colin rolls forward. Virgil uses the spade delicately to probe for the surface and feels for it with his hand as soil trickles down. Bartlett hauls on the rope until Mac's trolley reaches him.
Right.
While Mac dismounts, Virgil's spade dislodges more loose earth. He reaches up and pulls down a handful of grass.
Psst, Bartlett.
He drops it to Bartlett, who grins as he shows it to Mac. They both look up, hopefully. Virgil pushes the spade gently upwards. On the surface, the blade, twisting round and back, looks a little like a submarine's periscope. Virgil pulls it back and shoves his hand through the surface, gently widening the hole. Eventually, he pokes his head very slowly above ground and looks around. Not many yards away is the fence, and he can see the lights of the camp. He checks the position, withdraws, and faces Bartlett.
All right.
Hold on to yourself, Bartlett. You're 20 feet short.
What do you mean, 20 feet short?
You're 20 feet short of the woods. The hole is right here in the open. The guard is between us and the lights.
How could that happen? The survey took us...
What the difference does it make? It's happened.
They all sit for a moment. Virgil suddenly clambers up again. He pokes his head out just far enough to be able to see and looks round slowly. Below, Mac and Bartlett wait tensely.
Roger. Mac, I'm trying to think. We could postpone until we dig to the trees.
All the documents are dated today. It's now or never.
Virgil scrambles back down.
one chance. When the guard goes to the far end of the compound, you might be able to move your men out. I think I can make it to the woods, set up a signal when you're clear.
What about the goon towers?
That's a chance you're going to have to take, but they're going to be watching the compound, not the woods.
Virgil beams at Bartlett.
Mag, pass the word. Send down 30 feet of rope.
Send down 30 feet of rope!
Hendley looks back along the tunnel.
Send down 30 feet of rope! Send down 30 feet of rope!
What?
30 feet of rope!
What do they want that for? How the devil should I know? Get their rope!
The next man at the tunnel entrance goes back through the hut, past the queue of waiting men. Virgil's head appears above ground again. He watches as a guard moves away from him along the fence, heaves himself out of the ground, and lies flat.
How's it going, Tommy? Have you heard?
Some kind of foul-up, I think, sir.
Haven't they moved into the tunnel yet?
I don't think so, sir.
Ramsay glances at his watch. Bartlett's head appears from the ground. He hands the end of a length of rope to Virgil, who ties a knot in it and races for the edge of the woods, his light-coloured trousers bright against the dark trees. He dives behind a tree and knots the rope around the trunk. Bartlett returns below ground.
He's over there.
Bartlett knots the rope at the foot of the shaft and turns to Ashley Pitt.
Right. You go first, Eric. I'm staying here till we get moving.
Ashley Pitt grasps the rope. Outside, Virgil watches the guard's slow progress away from the hole and tugs on the rope. Ashley Pitt looks back at Bartlett.
See you in Piccadilly.
Scott's bar.
Right.
Ashley Pitt's briefcase appears on the surface, then his blonde head. He springs up and races for the trees.
Thank you. Good luck.
Right.
Ashley Pitt shakes Virgil's hand, slips into the wood, and Virgil looks back to the fence. The next man heads for the surface, throws out his case, scrambles up, and makes for the trees in a crouching run. He carries on past Virgil into the wood. Down below, Hendley helps Colin onto a trolley and sends it away. Further back along the tunnel, men are moving in orderly fashion.
We're moving.
In the hut, Danny is still leaning against a door.
Danny, they're moving through the tunnel now. They're getting out. Danny, when Warsaw fell, you escaped and came to England because you're a flyer. You came because you wanted to fly with us and fight the Germans. We can get out now. We can get back to England. Danny, if you don't go through that tunnel, everything you've done will have been for nothing. Nothing!
Danny looks round and licks his lips. Very slowly, he pushes himself upright and moves back into the queue. Danny reaches the shaft, still looking tense. Sedgwick puts out a hand to help, but Danny slips down quickly. Willie follows him. Mac is pulling another trolley through the tunnel.
Lights behind Mac.
Right. In here, Colin. Come on. Sit down.
Mac sends the trolley back while Bartlett helps Colin.
You're up, Sedgwick. I'll take over.
Sedgwick plants a big brown suitcase at the feet of his successor and jumps into the shaft.
What the hell have you got in here, a piano?
Oh, that's very funny, mate.
Sedgwick, you won't get this thing through.
Oh, come!
Sedgwick manoeuvres the case down the hole. Goff steps forward.
Was that Sedgwick with his steamer trunk? Who else? I wish he was home with his kangaroos.
Mac pulls Hendley through. He climbs off the trolley past Mac and Bartlett to the foot of the exit shaft.
We're 20 feet short.
How the hell can you...
20 feet short. Now, Hiltz is on the other end of that rope in the woods. As soon as you feel a couple of tugs, off you go. But you'll have to keep Colin low on the way across.
Right.
Good luck, Colin.
Thanks, Mac.
Hendley looks back from the shaft, and Bartlett shakes his hand. Hendley looks up again. Outside, Virgil stares up into the night sky.
What's that?
It's an air raid. God, no! The goons will pull the switches and we'll lose the lights in the tunnel.
Come on, Colin. We get out when the lights go down.
Hendley heads up the ladder. Virgil moves from behind his tree to see the camp lights. As he watches, they go out. In the tunnel, Danny's trolley stops. He looks up, alarmed, and the tunnel lights go out.
Willie! Willie!
Virgil races back to the shaft.
It's an air raid. Searchlights are out. Come on.
Virgil helps Hendley and Colin out of the shaft. Hendley, with one arm round Colin's shoulders, gets them to the trees.
Get him up.
They duck under some low branches and into the wood. In the pitch-black tunnel.
He's gonna kill!
Danny!
He's gonna kill!
Danny, it's all right. Hey, there's the lights. There's been in here. Light the fat lamps down there! There's been an air raid and they've cut the lights, Danny. Danny, in here the tunnel, it's all right. Listen to me.
Lamps flare into life.
Danny, look.
Danny stares at a lamp and picks it up.
Come on, fellas, move, move! We can get dozens out in this darkness.
Danny puts down the lamp. Outside, Virgil is waiting at the shaft.
What the hell's going on?
You go.
Danny.
Go.
Willie squeezes past Danny and onto the trolley. Grim-faced, Bartlett hauls him to the end.
What is this, Willie?
I brought Danny there.
Is he stuck in there?
He's all right.
Get him out fast.
Above, Virgil leans over the shaft. Willie hauls Danny in on the trolley. Danny goes up the ladder first, waits for Willie, who pats Virgil on the back, and they sprint into the wood. The branches shake, and they're gone. Bartlett hauls in the next man.
Up you go.
Max sends the trolley back. Up above, Virgil takes the man's bag and helps him out.
Give me a bag.
He helps the next one up. In the tunnel, the lights come on. Virgil scuttles back behind his tree. Another man emerges, crosses the open ground, waits beside Virgil for his companion, and they both go. Bartlett is pulling Sedgwick through the tunnel. Above, Virgil watches a guard taking a leisurely drag on a cigarette. The guard stops, looks around him. Virgil twitches the rope. Sedgwick's case slides up through the hole, followed by the man. He looks cautiously around. At the trees, he claps Virgil on the back and goes.
Roger, you and I had better get out of here. We won't have a chance of any of the trains. It's moving. We'll just have to pass the instructions from man to man.
Bartlett frowns, rubbing his fingers.
Right. I'll be right behind you.
Bartlett's slim black attaché case slides onto the grass. He slides out after it, pulls Mac's bag up, and the two of them cross to Virgil and squat down beside him, looking back at the camp. Cavendish, with a big light-coloured package, follows them. He trips as he leaves the shaft. The cigarette-smoking guard turns instantly.
Is there anyone?
Cavendish slides himself onto the package. The young guard moves away. The older man, the smoker, walks suspiciously towards the trees. Virgil, Mac and Bartlett slide back into the dark undergrowth, below ground.
Come on, come on.
The guard shines his torch over the open ground. At the foot of the shaft, Griff waits anxiously. Above, the guard looks around him. Cavendish lies motionless on the ground. The guard moves again, and Griff begins to climb the ladder. Griff scrambles up from the shaft.
Hey! Don't shoot!
Virgil comes forward.
Don't shoot! Don't shoot! Don't shoot!
Don't shoot! Virgil runs for it. Below ground.
Coming back!
Okay, guards appear. The guards spread out to search. Inside the camp, men are clambering back up the shaft into the hut. Strachwitz arrives and shoves them roughly against the wall, holding his gun over the shaft entrance. Below, Goff speeds along on a trolley.
Oh boy, there's a hell of a lot of shooting going on up there.
You only did be shooting them one by one as they came up to you?
No, it couldn't be. We would have heard the shots before.
Goff's companion mounts the trolley and whizzes back along the tunnel.
Oh! Wait for me!
moving!
Away!
Another man climbs into the hut and looks disconsolately at the grim-faced Strachwitz.
Out!
Yet another man emerges slowly, and Ramsay arrives, standing silently in the doorway. Goff's companion looks out of the shaft before climbing out. And finally, Goff appears.
Out.
The batch of five escapers files out of the room. In bright morning light, the Allied prisoners are on parade in the compound. Strachwitz salutes and hands a sheaf of papers to Captain Posen.
The Arsenal, Captain.
Posen glances down, marches to von Luger. They exchange salutes, and Posen hands over the papers. The commandant glances at the top sheet.
76.
Jawohl.
Posen takes his place behind von Luger.
How many did he say? 76.
76. 76. 76. 76.
Von Luger, his lean face cold and stiff, leafs through the papers, folds them, and looks up at Ramsay, who is directly in front of him. Ramsay gazes straight back. Von Luger swallows, blinks hard, and then stiffens to attention.
Dismiss!
Attention! Out!
Von Luger returns Ramsay's salute and moves off.
Shoot!
Mac and Bartlett slow down and check around as they climb the stairs at a railway station. Bartlett gives a little puff of relief, and they stroll onto the platform. Cavendish passes by without apparently seeing them. A sign reads Neustadt. To their right, Ashley Pitt is sitting reading the Völkische Beobachter. He turns the page of his paper. In the other direction, Hendley is guiding Colin towards the platform. Mac and Bartlett exchange rueful looks. Hendley gazes along the platform. Ashley Pitt lowers his gold-rimmed glasses to look at Nimmo in Luftwaffe uniform. Hendley leans close to Colin.
Half the guys who missed their trains are piled up in the station. Ashley Pitt, Roger, Donald, Nimmo. Makes quite a group.
What do we do?
Wait for the train.
Mac and Bartlett look round suddenly. Nimmo seems unconcerned as the train approaches. The big black engine, white smoke pouring from its smokestack, pulls into the platform as two grey motorbikes lead two grey cars into the station forecourt. Mac and Bartlett quickly board the train by the open-air stairs at the end of a carriage. Ashley Pitt strolls to another carriage, noticing Hendley and Colin nearer the end of the train. Nimmo boards the last carriage. Two plainclothes men get out of the cars, and one of them boards the train, with two grey uniformed policemen behind him, just as it pulls out. The huge engine, black on a base of red with red wheels, hauls its few carriages slowly away from the platform. The pure white column of smoke from its funnel broken momentarily by a footbridge over the tracks. Mac enters a carriage and hesitates. Two SS officers are sitting facing two empty seats. The man in the aisle seat is asleep, his polished calf boots resting on the empty seat opposite. Bartlett looks at the other officer. The officer looks up and nudges his companion. With a disgruntled expression, he moves his feet, and Mac and Bartlett sit on the plain wooden bench seat.
Seat?
In a quiet market square, Sedgwick strolls casually up to a row of parked bicycles. He puts his big brown suitcase on the luggage carrier behind the seat of one, puts his hand on the handlebar, and notices a chain and padlock around the front wheel. He looks surreptitiously around the square, slips a homemade pair of cutters from an inside pocket, bends down, and cuts the chain. He straightens up with a righteous expression, puts away the cutters, looks round again, lifts the bike off its stand, and rides away. The seat is too low for him, and his knees stick out as he pedals straight-backed down the street. At a bend in a country road, Virgil's head rises out of a ditch. He's wearing a black jacket over his cream-coloured trousers. He checks the road and hastily winds some wire around a black and white warning post at the roadside. He secures the wire, makes a crouching run to a post on the opposite side of the road, and ties the wire to that. He checks that it's tight and hops down into the ditch. A soldier on a motorbike comes down the middle of the road, leans over to take the bend, skids, and comes off. He finishes up motionless on the far side of the ditch. Two figures in workmen's clothes and caps run down a grassy slope through some young trees and find themselves on the bank of a wide river. A modern concrete bridge is to their right. Looking to their left, they see a rowing boat pulled up on the bank. Willie looks at Danny. They nod and head for the boat. A truck pulls up beside a gentle hill on which sheep are grazing. Cavendish touches the brim of his hat and gets up beside the driver, the large white package under his arm. Danny pushes the boat away from the bank and takes the oars while Willie settles in the stern with one hand on the tiller. Danny pulls away easily, and the boat moves peacefully up the center of the river, past trees and fields, with a few houses in the distance, towards the bridge. Virgil, wearing the field grey uniform of the German army, his helmet tilted rakishly back, jumps the bike over the ditch and onto the road, checks both ways, adjusts his collar, and heads off in the same direction the soldier was going. The train chugs along the top of an embankment, past fields full of ripe golden wheat. Inside, Hendley lights a cigarette as the guard, a portly elderly man in a dark blue uniform with a shiny red sash, enters the carriage and rolls up the aisle. Hendley waits a few seconds, touches Colin's arm and follows. From a seat on the other side of the aisle, Ashley Pitt watches him expressionlessly. Hendley steps into the next carriage and surveys it. He sees Mac and Bartlett sitting opposite the SS officers. The far door opens, and the young plainclothes man who boarded at Neustadt enters, followed by the two policemen. Hendley retreats. The civilian stands over Mac.
Ihre Pässe, bitte.
In his own carriage, Hendley, pretending to look out of the window, leans over Ashley Pitt.
Tally-ho.
At his own seat, Hendley taps Colin, who stands, and they leave the carriage by the door furthest from the police. Two elderly women sitting behind them watch curiously. Ashley Pitt frowns slightly, puts on his glasses, and picks up his Völkischer Beobachter. The plainclothes man examines Bartlett's pass.
Vous êtes français?
Oui, moi aussi.
The plainclothes man raises his eyebrows and hands back their passes.
Merci.
The security men move on. Mac and Bartlett glance at each other. Entering another carriage, Hendley stumbles into Nimmo. He touches his hat brim and walks on. The plainclothes man examines Ashley Pitt's documents.
Sie reisen für eine Firma?
Ja.
Für mein Geschäft.
Ashley Pitt passes over a card from his wallet.
Danke.
The plainclothes man leads the police out of the carriage. Hendley and Colin step onto the small platform at the very back of the train.
Are the police on the train?
Yes, the staff are with us. We're going to jump.
All right.
Hendley releases a bar at the top of some steps and guides Colin down them.
I'll tell you when.
I'd prefer you just to give me a good firm push.
Hendley peers along the track ahead. The train is still trundling along an embankment lined with telegraph poles and running alongside meadows. Hendley throws his briefcase off and jumps, hanging on to Colin. They roll wildly down the embankment. Hendley grabs Colin again and drags him behind a stack of cut hay. He leans out and looks after the train.
Are you all right?
Yes, I'm fine. That's quite exciting. It isn't stopping.
No, we're all right.
A white church tower surmounted by an onion dome dominates a quiet little town. Sedgwick, knees still sticking out sharply from his bicycle, freewheels down a slight slope along a sand-coloured track with wooden railing fences on either side and out into open country. He puffs a little as he gazes about him at the gentle green fields. The rowing boat is travelling quickly, aided by the fast-flowing river. They're approaching a town, and Willie angles the boat to shoot the piers of a bridge. Virgil's bike flies along a flat, straight road. Passing a small wood, he can see water ahead, and beyond, mountains. He comes to a halt, looking up at them.
Switzerland.
He unscrews the petrol filler cap and rocks the bike from side to side, gauging the fuel in the tank. He replaces it, biting his lip, and sets off again. Sedgwick rides slowly over a level crossing. He stops halfway across, looking to his right at a stationary locomotive, gently puffing and steaming. He licks his lips and glances around. A squad of German soldiers with motorbikes and cars are casually gathered around a crossroads. Virgil stops in the middle of the junction. Virgil sighs, swings the bike around, and rides over to his questioner.
Wo willst du denn hin? Zeig mir mal deinen Ausweis.
Hey!
Virgil kicks the man in the stomach and guns the bike away. Motorbike combinations and a solo bike set off in pursuit. Virgil swings down a dirt track between houses to find the pursuers coming straight towards him. He turns with the Germans only yards behind. Tearing along a path through a field, he reaches a narrow wooden bridge and crosses it. The chasing combination crashes into the bridge railings, throwing out the sidecar rider. Virgil continues across an open field, with three bikes close behind. Sedgwick heaves open the door of a goods wagon, clambers in, reaches down for his suitcase, and closes the door. The train driver is leaning out of his cab and looking back along the side of the train as the big black engine lumbers slowly over the level crossing. Virgil's bike crests a rise in a rich green meadow. He accelerates up to a big wooden barn standing at the highest point of the meadow and grimaces. The village is behind him and dark trees line the tops of the higher hills nearby. He turns the bike and, slithering and sliding over the grass, looks all around. He returns to the barn, slaps the wall and kicks it. Leaning the bike against the barn wall, he takes off his helmet and listens to his pursuers. Two bikes and two cars are throwing up white dust from a narrow track. He listens again and draws his pistol. Leaning against a corner of the barn, he takes careful aim as the first bike races across the pale-coloured cart track. A solo bike leads the motorbike combination and a car along a left fork in the track, away from the barn, and Virgil lowers the gun. He looks around again, squinting in the bright sunshine. His fingers hover over the buttons of his uniform jacket. He puts the gun down and starts to undo his belt and jacket. Two soldiers, an officer and a plainclothes man, wait by the track at a station. Name boards read Ettingen. A train draws in, and the Gestapo man in the long leather coat who brought Bartlett to the camp moves forward to watch as people begin to get off. Several elderly people climb stiffly down the steps from the carriage nearest him, and he moves along the train. Behind the older people, Bartlett and Mac dismount and stride along with their briefcases like two businessmen. Members of the Hitler Youth are handing out leaflets, and Mac takes one from a young woman as he passes. the end of the platform, two plainclothes men are checking papers. Ashley Pitt, his smart pale grey hat pulled down over his eyes, sees the Gestapo man and turns aside as if to put his paper in his case. The Gestapo man strolls towards the queue forming at the security check. Ashley Pitt looks up and starts walking again, watching the Gestapo man just ahead of him. He stops when the man does. The Gestapo man is staring at the queue. Ashley Pitt, a few feet behind and to one side of him, watches carefully. Bartlett turns his head, and the Gestapo man gets a profile view of him.
Bartlett.
Ashley Pitt hurls himself at the man, who draws his pistol. Ashley Pitt grabs the man's gun hand. The man twitches and lies still. Ashley Pitt sprints back along the platform. Bartlett and Mac walk briskly towards the station exit.
Eyes out, everyone! Hear me again!
People dive to the ground, giving the security men a clear shot. Ashley Pitt's hands fly up. He stumbles, falls, and rolls onto the track. After a moment, he stands and staggers 7 or 8 paces. He falls again. He blinks once, and his head slumps. The truck carrying Cavendish drives into a little town and turns left into a yard. Cavendish's mouth opens. In front of him, a squad of soldiers are all aiming rifles directly at him. The driver looks at him, unsmiling. Cavendish stands in front of the other Gestapo man who brought Bartlett to the camp.
Where are you going, Cavendish?
I hadn't quite decided.
What information were you to collect on the way?
None.
What sabotage directions did you receive? What have you done with your papers?
Papers?
Forged papers and identity cards. Don't be so stupid. What did you do with them?
All I did was to escape from the prison camp. You'd do the same if you'd been locked up for 3 years. I wanted to get home.
I don't think you'll ever see your wife and children again.
You've obviously got the wrong man. I'm not even married.
You're wearing civilian clothes. You're a spy. Spies are being shot.
This is my uniform. I had to recut it when I lost weight. I dyed it with some boot polish to cover some oil smears I picked up when I was shot down.
The Gestapo man moves a file to one side of his desk, watched by the cold-eyed SS officer beside Cavendish. They all turn as a side door opens.
And you lost your insignia over the years.
That's right.
Bring in into den anderen.
The door behind Cavendish opens to admit another escaper.
That's our Cavendish.
A uniformed soldier escorts Cavendish out by the side door. Cavendish, with soldiers before and behind him, is marched along a stone-vaulted dungeon corridor and let into a dimly lit room where other disconsolate men sit on the floor or lean against the walls. He walks up to a man in German military uniform.
Hello, Haines.
Hello, Cavendish. Wish I could say I was happy to see you again. Just picked up.
Yes, this morning.
Hendley and Collins stumble into a dark building. Behind them stands a circular airfield control tower. They stop beside an aeroplane marked with a black Nazi swastika. On the far side of the hangar, a sentry patrols among the parked planes.
Trainer out there, I can fly.
Many sentries?
Yeah, that's going to be a problem.
Holding Colin by the shoulders, Hendley guides him through the hangar. They press themselves to the side of a plane as the sentry passes. When he's out of sight, they duck under a wing and hurry to the hangar entrance and press themselves tight to the wall. Hendley stares out at the airfield, and as soon as the sentry reappears, rushes at him and knocks his legs from under him. As the man rises, Hendley kicks him in the chin. Checking first that the sentry is unconscious, Hendley drags him back into the hangar. He deposits the man, takes Colin by the arm, and picking up the sentry's rifle on the way, leads him out to a small, single-propeller trainer. He stands Colin by the plane's fuselage, hops onto the wing, opens the cockpit, and stows the rifle. He looks around inside, and comes out with a starting handle. He thrusts it into a hole in the fuselage, and puts the end into Colin's hands.
Colin, when
I say go. Crank this clockwise. When the engine catches, don't move. You got a mouthful of propeller.
He returns to the cockpit, adjusting something on the wing on the way, and settles himself inside.
Go.
Colin turns the starting handle, and very slowly the propeller turns too. Colin cranks faster and faster. In the cockpit, Hendley fiddles with the controls. In the control tower, two men peer through the gloom. One of the men in the tower is watching through binoculars. Hendley gets out onto the wing of the little plane and helps Colin into the cockpit. In the tower, the second man is talking into the phone, eyes still on Hendley and Colin. The plane taxis to the runway and accelerates. A very short takeoff run gets them airborne. On the ground behind them, several figures are running across the airfield. The little plane flies low over a dark green pine forest. Ahead lie fields and a road. Hendley grins.
Next stop, Switzerland!
Virgil, now in his prison outfit of light-coloured jeans and blue t-shirt, races the bike out of a village and along a narrow road. Seeing a heavily manned guard post ahead, he stops. Behind, his pursuers are closing. Men from the guard post start running towards him. More bikes tear along the road from the village. He guns the engine and sets off across the fields. The first of the chasing bikes overshoots a turn, swings round, and follows a combination already hurtling up the dusty track. Virgil bursts through a line of trees and bounces up a steep hill, leaving tire tracks in the grass. At the crest of the rise, he accelerates again, crosses a track, and speeds up another uneven, grassy slope. The soldiers keep to their track, travelling fast. Standing up in the saddle, and sometimes bouncing the bike clear of the ground, Virgil reaches the top of a steep incline, looks around, and stops. A village lies in the valley below. Over to his right rise steep, wooded mountains. Panting hard, he sets off towards a little group of trees, with more mountains beyond. In bright sunshine, the little trainer flies over a green valley.
The Alps! Splendid!
Clearing the valley and more dark woodland, the plane crosses a lake with sharp, jagged and snow-capped mountains ahead.
Over this range, then 20 more minutes, we got it made.
Colin smiles happily. They fly through a valley dominated by a white castle with one high tower and cross more farmland, with trees dotting a landscape of ripe wheat. Hendley scowls at the control panel. The plane starts to lose height, dropping towards the lake. He struggles with the controls as they swoop low over the water and clear it, heading down to rough ground and trees.
What is it? Petrol? I don't know. Fuel pump primarily. We're losing power.
Hendley throws a protective arm across Colin's chest. The plane plunges down and slides between two trees. The wings are ripped off. The fuselage slithers to a stop and begins to burn. Hendley opens the cockpit and falls out, turning to help Colin struggle out after him. He wipes his face and shakes his head. Colin reaches out to him, and Hendley pushes him away from the plane.
Go that way! I'll follow!
Colin stumbles forward and picks himself up at the edge of the trees, looking down over a field towards a farmhouse and a church. As he staggers uncertainly, an armored car pulls up on the road 50 yards away. Soldiers climb out. By the plane, Hendley wipes more blood from his face. Colin is standing as if trying to spy out the land. A soldier raises his rifle. Colin turns back to Hendley.
Hendley!
Colin falls. Hendley lurches to his feet.
Colin!
He limps towards Colin, waving his arms at the soldiers. Hendley drops to his knees and rolls Colin over into his arms.
Colin? I'm sorry I fouled things up.
That's all right. Thank you for getting me out.
Soldiers surround them as Colin falls back. Hendley, blood smeared across his distraught face, stares round at them and back at Colin. Against a backdrop of dark wooded hills, Virgil bounces up and over more undulating grassland, across a flat stretch with the white peaks of the Alps ahead, and reaches a fence. Tall, heavy baulks of wood are crossed over to form an endless row of X's, standing sideways onto him, linked and braced by long crosspieces. Barbed wire runs along the top and fills the gaps. 10 yards beyond them, an identical fence combines with the first to form an impenetrable barrier. Behind Virgil, two trucks disgorge soldiers. Bikes follow him across the grass. Virgil sets off along the length of the fence. Virgil slews to a halt as a long line of soldiers appears over the slope in front of him. He turns and accelerates back along the fence, riding hard into a sudden dip and flying out of it high enough to clear the first fence. He lands safely, roars along between the two fences and sees soldiers running towards him. He swings the bike round again, back along the flat stretch between the fences. The bike slides sideways, throwing Virgil off, leaving him entangled in hoops of barbed wire. He struggles to rise, then flops back onto the grass.
Los, aufstehen!
A young soldier points a rifle at him. Virgil reaches forward to pat the bullet-riddled tank of the bike and looks at the soldier as he slowly pulls himself free of the wire.
Ende hoch!
Grimacing with pain and with one leg soaked in leaking petrol, Virgil hoists himself to his feet and lifts one bleeding hand to turn over the neckband of his t-shirt, showing them his military identifying dog tags. He smiles as he raises the hand not still caught in the wire. A German military car crosses a bridge in a quiet town. The driver stops at an open-air cafe beside the river, and three officers get out and sit at a small marble-top table. A young, dark-haired man at the counter, wearing a black waistcoat and long white apron, puts down a cigarette and goes to them. On the way, he checks his pocket watch.
Hey, bonjour, monsieur. Comment ça va? Ça va bien?
Bonjour, Aristide.
Comme d'habitude, trois pernos, n'est-ce pas?
Trois pernos.
Oui, monsieur. Trois pernos, papa.
The only other customer, sitting just behind the Germans, lowers his copy of Libération and looks at them. It is Sedgwick. He turns a page of the paper as the young man picks up a tray with three glasses and a carafe.
Café Suzette? Oui?
The young man puts down the phone and takes the tray to the officers.
Et voilà, monsieur, les trois pernos.
Merci.
Deux. Et trois. Et voilà de l'eau. Bon appétit, monsieur.
Merci.
Glancing around, the young man moves to Sedgwick's table.
Monsieur, téléphone pour vous.
Téléphone pour moi?
Oui, monsieur, téléphone. Téléphone, venez ici, par ici. Voilà, monsieur, téléphone.
He leads Sedgwick by the arm.
Merci. Hello? Hello?
While Sedgwick glances away, father and son duck down behind the counter. Sedgwick sees them, puts down the phone and joins them. A black Citroen crosses the bridge and stops in front of the Germans, who stare at it. The muzzle of a heavy machine gun appears through the window of the rear door. The Germans lie sprawled on the ground. Father and son stand slowly. The son pours two cognacs and they toast each other before drinking. Sedgwick stands.
Resistance.
Resistance?
You are English.
I'm Australian. Dites-moi...
You can speak English, I understand.
Bloody good. I'm a British officer. I've just escaped from a prisoner of war camp in Germany. I'm trying to make my way into Spain now. You understand me?
Oui. Oh,
can you help me now?
Father and son look at each other.
Eh?
I know someone who can.
Bloody good.
They push Sedgwick inside. Mac and Bartlett join a queue of people boarding a bus. As they reach the steps, one of two men standing by the door pulls a metal identity tag from his pocket.
Geheime Staatspolizei, Ihren Ausweis bitte.
Bartlett and Mac reach into their inside pockets and offer documents.
Ah, français.
Jawohl.
Commençons.
Eh oui. Parlez-vous français?
Un peu.
Votre accent est très bon.
Oh, je l'ai tout fait dans l'école supérieure.
The two Englishmen smile weakly.
Eh bien, passez.
Si.
Au revoir, monsieur.
Au revoir.
Au revoir. Good luck.
Thank you.
The policeman grabs Mac while Bartlett runs for it. In the confusion, Mac gets away too. Both sprint down the street. A grey military car swings up beside the bus. Mac and Bartlett race along a narrow street and dash either side of a startled man leading a horse and cart. The policeman instructs the soldiers, who drive off. Women turn and stare at Mac and Bartlett racing along another street. Bartlett stops and tries to open a door without success. They run on and Mac tries a second door. They sprint out of an alleyway into another street, turning to look around them as they run. Mac runs full tilt into a cyclist and both crash to the ground. Bartlett hesitates. Mac stands and dashes off into a different alley. Seeing soldiers at the far end, he turns and runs down the street away from Bartlett. Mac turns again, sprinting into a corner, desperately tries a door, turns to face two soldiers and tries to burst between them. They catch him and slam him back against the wall. One reaches into his pocket and pulls out his papers. Bartlett, hatless and without his briefcase, is running across the roofs. He reaches a low wall with four strands of barbed wire protecting it, steps carefully over them, hops down into an empty street and runs towards the next corner. Walking along a narrow street, he stops and turns away. A military car pulls up beside him.
Soldiers!
You are English?
Engländer!
So you betrayed me with a pistol? Nehmen Sie sie sofort weg.
Ach, Sie sind Deutscher.
Selbstverständlich.
Schon gut. Weitergehen. Entschuldigung.
The German officer puts away his pistol, gets back into the car, and Bartlett stands beside his door as it drives off. In yet another quiet street, Bartlett takes a newspaper from a rack, leaves a coin, and starts to trot across the road. He slows to a walk and stops at the corner, glancing around. He leans back against the wall, panting, and opens the paper.
Herr Bartlett?
Bartlett stiffens, folds the paper, and very slowly turns to face a tall, heavily built SS officer.
Heuser Fröhlich.
Your German is good. And I hear also your French. Your arms. Up!
He gets out his pistol and holds it to Bartlett's chest. Bartlett slowly raises his hands. In the castle office, the Gestapo man watches the smiling SS officer put down the phone.
Ausgezeichnet.
The SS man presses a button on the desk, puts on his cap and straightens up, holding his gloves in both hands. They both look to the door. Bartlett stands outside, handcuffed. The SS man who captured Bartlett marches him to the desk.
Herr Bartlett. And Herr MacDonald.
Mac looks up from a seat at the side of the room.
Oh, we are together again. You are going to wish you had never put us to so much trouble.
Almost smiling under his clipped moustache, he presses the button on his desk. On a grey, misty morning, a military car leads a convoy of three canvas-sided trucks guarded by motorbike combinations. In the back of one truck, an unshaven Mac looks at Bartlett.
What's troubling you, Roger?
I'm just a little surprised. I expected either a long stay or a very short trip.
Yes.
I have to admit, I'm a little worried, though. I hope to God I haven't blotted 70-odd ledgers.
Oh, no. We're all over 21, footloose and fancy-free. We'd never have got as far as we did without you, Roger. For what it's worth, I think you did a damn good job. I think we all do.
Next to Mac, Cavendish remains expressionless. At a small crossroads, the first truck drives straight on, the second turns right, and the third left. Mac looks up as their truck slows. The staff car drives into a field, and a truck pulls up beside it. Soldiers emerge and open the canvas flap at the back of the truck. with others standing by, weapons at the ready. The SS officer from the Gestapo office watches as the prisoners frown in the sudden light.
Was ist los? Wo sind wir?
All right, you can get out now. Stretch your legs for 5 minutes. It'll take hours before you reach the camp.
Led by Bartlett and Mac, the prisoners climb down, stretching and walking slowly across a green field with steep wooded hills in the distance. Bartlett stops, staring up at the mist-shrouded hills, hands in his coat pocket.
You know, Mac, all this, the organization, tunneling, Tom and Harry, kept me alive. And even though I've never been happier. You know, Mac...
He turns quickly to see a heavy machine gun being set up. He stares as the soldier adjusts the ammunition belt. Three figures are silhouetted against the mist, standing quite still between a motorbike and a truck. On a sunny day, Wing Commander Ramsey limps up the stairs to the commandant's hut. Strachwitz salutes. Ramsey returns the compliment and a soldier opens the door for him. Inside, Posen ushers Ramsey into von Luger's office. Posen stands beside the desk. Von Luger is twisting his hands together. He doesn't look up.
11 of your men are being returned today.
Oh, who?
I do not have some information. I am directed by higher authority to inform you that 50 of your officers were shot while escaping.
Shot?
The personal effects will be returned.
How many of them were wounded?
We ask the names of the dead.
How many of the 50 were wounded?
None. The higher authority only directs me to inform you that 50 men were...
I see.
Ramsey stands in front of a full parade.
Addison, John. Allerdale, Peter. Bancroft, Edward. Bartlett, Roger. Cavendish, Dennis.
Eldridge, David, Elton, William, Fanshawe, Arthur.
Danny rows the rowing boat across the still waters of a port with cranes lining the quayside. He pauses as he comes under the stern of a big freighter, the Alta from Stockholm, pulling again as Willie steers round her stern and along her port side, where hidden from the quay, there's a ladder up to her deck. At the foot of the ladder, Danny stops rowing. Willie grabs the oars while Danny hangs onto the foot of the ladder. Willie steps onto the ladder, helps up Danny, who pushes away the rowing boat, and they climb up. Three men stop under some silver birch trees at the edge of a wheat field. The leader, in a black beret and with a submachine gun, checks around warily. Sedgwick looks at him.
Ici?
Oui, monsieur, c'est ici. Alors, au revoir.
Merci beaucoup, monsieur.
Pas de quoi. Au revoir.
Au revoir.
Bonne chance.
Sedgwick and the leader shake hands. The third man lifts a hand in farewell, and the two Frenchmen go. Sedgwick steps into the open. A lean man carrying a rifle steps into the open beside Sedgwick and stares across the field.
I am your guide, senor.
Spain?
España.
Sedgwick slaps the man's shoulder and follows him across the field, with trees and a craggy mountain ahead of them. At the camp, Ramsey and a full parade of prisoners watch a group of escapers come slowly through the gate, Hendley at the front. Ramsey steps forward.
Nat, see, you're all safe.
Thank you, sir. How many have been brought back?
You're the first.
Do you know how many got away, sir?
Not yet. What happened to Blythe?
He didn't make it, sir. Roger was right about that.
I'm afraid Roger didn't make it either. I've just posted the list. They shot 50. The Gestapo murdered them.
Strachwitz swallows hard.
50?
MacDonald, Ashley Pitt?
Yes. Danny and Willie?
No, they're not on the list.
Haynes?
Yes. I'm sorry. Roger's idea was to get back at the enemy the hardest way he could. Mess up the works. From what we've heard here, I think he did exactly that.
Do you think it was worth the price?
It depends on your point of view, Henley.
Yes, sir.
The escapers set off grimly for the huts. A car with a motorbike escort stops in front of the commandant's hut. In the back is the big SS officer who captured Bartlett. He marches up the steps to the office and lets himself in. The sentries stand at ease. Strachwitz, on his way back to the office, stops to watch a second car pull up. The driver holds the door open, and Virgil steps out, handcuffed and smiling slightly, followed by a Luftwaffe officer. Von Luger comes out of the office, followed by the SS man.
He is not to be saluted. He's no longer in command.
Virgil looks from one to the other. Von Luger stops at the foot of the steps and gazes at Virgil.
Job just didn't work out, huh?
You were lucky, Hiltz.
Lucky? It won't be because I didn't...
He glances at the SS man.
How many?
50. It looks, after all, as if you will see Berlin before I do.
He looks over at Ramsey and the prisoners on parade as he gets into the first car. The SS man sits beside him. The officer who brought Virgil unlocks his handcuffs. Captain Posen is standing stiff and unsmiling on the veranda of the commandant's hut. Virgil looks up at him, grins, and takes a couple of paces towards the hut. The cuts from the barbed wire still show on his face, arms, and clothes. Two guards step forward to escort Virgil into the compound. Ramsey smiles slightly as he watches the American's jaunty entrance.
Sir?
The men break ranks as Virgil heads for the cooler. Goff runs to intercept him.
Hey, Hilt!
He lobs the baseball mitt to Virgil, who catches it and grins. He strolls into the grey, murky interior of the cooler, along the corridor, and stops by a door. The same young guard who locked him up last time pulls open the door. They look at each other. Virgil goes in, and the guard locks up. Walking back down the corridor, the guard stops, looks back, and then continues. Red letters read, "This picture is dedicated to the 50. The End, released through United Artists. Audio description written by Peter Wickham. Read by Richard Mitchley. Studio engineer Sue Malpass. Cast: Robert Graff as Werner the Ferret. Nigel Stock as Cavendish, the Surveyor. Angus Lenny as Ives, the Mole. John Layton as Willie, Tunnel King. Gordon Jackson as MacDonald, Intelligence. David McCallum as Ashley Pitt, Dispersal. Hannes Messimer as Von Luger, the Commandant. James Coburn as Sedgwick, Manufacturer. Donald Pleasance as Blythe, Forger. Charles Bronson as Danny, Tunnel King. James Donald as Ramsey, the SBO. Richard Attenborough as Bartlett, Big X. James Garner as Hendley, the Scrounger. Steve McQueen as Virgil Hiltz, the Cooler King. Also featuring Judd Taylor, Hans Reiser, Harry Riebauer, William Russell, Robert Freitag, Ulrich Beiger, George Mikkel, Lawrence Montaigne, Robert Desmond, Till Kiever, Heinz Weiss, Tom Adams, Carl Otto Alberti. Director of Photography, Daniel L. Fapp, ASC. Art Director, Fernando Carriere. Film Editor, Ferris Webster. Assistant to Producer, Robert L. Rivier. Filmed in Panavision. Production Supervisor, Alan K. Wood. Assistant Director, Jack N. Reddish. Script Supervisor, John Franco. Music Editor, Richard Carruth. Sound Effects Editor, Wayne Fury. Set Decorator, Kurt Ripberger. Property, Frank Agnoni. Makeup, Emile Levine, SML. Special Effects, Paul Pollard. Wardrobe, Bert Henriksen. Assistant Film Editor, Don Tomlinson. Casting, Stalmaster Lister Company. Colour, by Deluxe.